Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, a very good Saturday morning out there. The hail and severe weather didn't materialize, at least around this area that I'm aware of last night. But a lot of folks got another at least half inch of rain out of it. So starting this Saturday with wet soil, and looks like it's going to be a pretty day. Golly, the weather was just beautiful this past week to get out and get things done outside, and so much to do outside, so much to do in the garden, and that's what we're here to talk about for the next 3.5 hours. Looking at my log this morning, looks like there's pretty light commercial loads, so probably time for lots of phone calls. Clint's going to be up first, but call me early. Don't put it off. Let's talk. There's so many interesting things going on and so much to do out in the garden, both with vegetables and flowers and, oh, gosh, time to plant all kinds of things in the way of spring bulbs. We've got a lot to talk about. Anyway, you know the number, 210-599-5555, and we get the morning started with Clint. Good morning, Clint.
Good morning. How's it going?
Oh, it's just going along. Still lots of lightning, looks like, down your way. Did you get a storm or get any moisture last night?
Last night, inch and a half.
Oh, man. That'll make you smile.
Oh, yeah. The week before, between the 2 days, I got 6.7.
Well, you're way ahead of those of us in the Hill Country and a little bit ahead of San Antonio, but that'll put some water in the ground and put some water in the aquifers and creeks and rivers, so it's a good thing. Let's just hope it keeps up this spring.
I'm surprised Medina Lake didn't go up at all with any of that rain.
Very, very little water over the catchment area there. The rain was all south of Medina, and Medina has a very small area that fills it. It's, you know, you look at a lake like Canyon or some of the others, they're spread out all over the place, but it's a relatively small amount of land that catches the water that goes into the Medina River and ultimately into Medina Lake, and consequently, they have to have rain pretty much right on top of them to get a lot of benefit, and they just didn't get it last week. Yeah, you know, when you were getting your 6 to 8 inches, San Antonio getting 5 to 6, I'm kind of between Medina Lake and San Antonio, and I got 1.88, which I was very happy for, but that's a third of the rain that some of the rest of you guys got. So, you know, like they say, wait till next time. For me, it was 0.62 this morning, which is anything over half an inch is a good rain, but I'm always ready for more.
What is the area that Medina Lake needs?
It is actually, it would be west of Fredericksburg, west of Kerrville. Actually, probably not as far up as Fredericksburg, but west and southwest of Kerrville.
Oh, okay, I have to look at that map. I figured it'd be a little bit bigger than that.
Yeah, it's, you know, you have to look at a topographic map to tell. But there's an awful lot of water goes, you know, west of there, and an awful lot of water east of there that actually some of it goes into the Guadalupe. There's a lot of hilly land around there, but a lot of it just drains the other directions.
Well, my first, this is like three and a half inches that first day. I was quite amazed how it pretty much got sucked up really fast. I've been so dry for so long.
Amen to that. It's nice that we're finally getting some moisture into that, oh, that kind of middle ground from about 2 feet to about 6 feet down. Of course, you've got a little more permeable soil than some of us do, but we've had rains this year that would keep the upper footer so wet, which is great for the grasses and some of the forbs and some of the shrubby things, but this is the kind of rain the trees needed, so it's just a good thing all the way around.
Most definitely. Now, I'm going to ask you the tea tree, not the tea tree, but the tea you drink, Camellia sinensis. Does that grow in this area?
No, sir. We're too cold in the winters.
Too cold.
It's very much a tropical plant, and it's not happy, I would say, below 55, 60 degrees. And when we start getting down in the 30s and 40s, it just pretty much stops doing anything, and get below freezing, it dies. So, that old saying, all the tea in China, certainly applies to the more tropical areas. And when you look at how much of it is grown, literally all over the world, but it's all more, I wouldn't say necessarily in equatorial regions, but in the areas with a warmer year-round average temperature.
Okay, so I guess that leaves that idea out. Any kind of fruit that most people haven't thought of for this area would work well?
There are a lot of different, oddball fruit trees. There's a nursery, I think they're still there down in the Harlingen area, called River Bend Nursery, kind of up a little north of Harlingen. And those people grow more different, unusual kinds of fruit. We were at a seminar somewhere in South Texas, and they put on a program and brought samples of things for people to taste. And some of it was good, some of it kind of questionable, but there's some unusual things, out there. Walk through the grocery store and take a look at some of the unusual things there. They're unusual things to grow, but are they marketable? That's where the question is. People tend not to buy things they aren't familiar with.
Well, some of that stuff looks downright ugly and questionable.
And that's why there is actually that one that is called ugly fruit. But a lot of it, like they say, it was a brave man who ate the first oyster. It's a brave person that discovered some of these other things were edible, and some of them, some things ripen, some things really don't get flavorful until they ferment, and that leads to some interesting things in the animal world when they start eating the fermented fruit. And saw a video on National Geographic or something one time of a bunch of drunk elephants that had imbibed heavily or had consumed heavily of some of the well-fermented fruit. And humorous things happen in the animal world sometimes.
Oh, yeah, it's kind of funny seeing a bunch of drunk birds.
Yeah, I grew up spending summers with my grandparents in Dallas, and there was a lot about three houses down that had a bunch of chinaberry trees, and had some, third, fourth cousins live down in right there, and they had an old tomcat that would go out and just sit underneath the trees. He didn't have to hunt the birds. The robins and the all would sit up in those trees and eat the fermented berries until they just tumbled out of the trees, and he'd just go over and pick up his dinner off the ground. So, there are a lot of humorous things if you open your eyes to nature.
Like shooting fish in the barrel for that cat.
Yeah, it's something like that, only easier.
Oh, definitely. Now, getting back to the field, the coastal is dormant, but what about the roots?
Oh, no, the roots are active. Roots pretty much stay active, and, the little root hairs, the part that actually do the absorbing, they're in full growth through the winter months. So, you've got a lot going on below the surface of the ground, but nothing above the ground, and nothing will happen until the soil temperature warms up. But you've got a whole group of microbes that work in colder soils called psychrophilic microbes, and they're busy doing all sorts of things, and the roots of the plants are very busy benefiting from that. There's a lot of nutrient absorption actually goes on because the microbes are processing the fertilizer materials that have been added either by you or by nature, turning them into things that are both absorbable by the plants and things that the plants can use in root growth. So, in the winter months, what goes on below the ground certainly doesn't stop. It may be a different group of microbes take over. That's why you're such an expert on compost tea. And you well know that's why you want your compost tea at room temperature or ambient temperature, because you know that the microbes that are going to benefit the soil are a whole different group when it's really hot or medium range or a little bit chilly. But, you know, among the tens of thousands that are out there, there are plenty of them that are very active in colder soil.
And the roots actually grow during this time?
Yes, absolutely. If you ever want to be convinced of that, you know, just get a piece of sod from somewhere and just lay it down, roll it good, water it, and then go back and try to pull it up 3 or 4 weeks later, and you'll find that lots of roots already starting down into the ground. Depends on the variety of grass, and of course, coastal doesn't grow quite as quickly as some of the other things like, you know, oats and some of your cool weather grasses do, but it certainly stays active.
So I'm guessing come springtime, I'm going to be quite surprised.
Well, hopefully so, and it's, you know, always beneficial to put out your compost tea, to put out your molasses, put out fertilizer if you can afford it this time of year, because that lets the plants process the nutrients in those fertilizer products to where the plants can really make a strong growth in spring. So many people make the mistake, they don't want to fertilize until they see green growth coming out on the plants, and they're way behind the curve, because the fertilizer they put on at that point isn't really going to be available to the plants till mid-spring. So awful lot of things to be doing to improve your hay fields or whatever this time of year.
I got my 2 tons of Medina down about a month ago. So
perfect. Yeah, just perfect.
Please enjoying all that. All right, well, I sure appreciate your time.
Well, it's always a pleasure visiting with you, and you get out and enjoy this wonderful weekend.
You too. Take care.
Thank you so much. Goodbye. Don, anybody else holding out there? George is up next. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have made some mistakes not listening to what you said first. I thought I'd try you first this time.
Well, it'll be my pleasure to try to help. I've made one or two mistakes myself, and that's what I always say my job is, to keep you from making the same mistakes I've made. But what's going on that concerns you?
Well, I have a patch of blackberries, and a couple of years ago, I thought I was doing a pretty smart thing, and I had some composted manure. I put it in there, and along the way came a couple of some sprigs of coastal Buddha. And and it's been me against the coastal ever since. And I've kind of come to where I can just learn to grow around it. But I'm wanting maybe have a patch of berries that is coastal free. And would this be a good time of the year? As I have also learned, those blackberry plants really do put up a lot of shoots.
They do.
Pull up those shoots, bare root, and put them in a raised. I'm going to just dedicate one of my raised beds to growing blackberries without the coastal in it. Is that a plausible thing? Pull those out of the ground, or dig them up and shake them off?
Dig them up. Once the little plant is, you know, 3-4 inches tall, the blackberries produce sort of an underground runner, and they get out to a certain point, and then they start forming that little plantlet that, you know, makes leaves and stems above the ground and makes roots below the ground. But once those little blackberry plants have gotten 3 or 4 inches tall, they've developed enough roots. I wouldn't physically pull them. You'll damage the developing roots too much, but you know, just a shovel full of dirt is all you need. I will, you know, take a shovel and just kind of go around, make a little circle around them, maybe 6-8 inches wide, and then just use a broad blade of that shovel to get underneath it, lift it, take it over, and put it in the ground wherever I want to grow it. Just be very careful that you're not getting any rhizomes of the coastal that are in there, because you know, they're going to be pretty tenacious all through the area. If you have to bare root the blackberries, if you've got that much coastal that you can't get the little plants out without worrying about getting some sprigs of coastal in it, then actually dig it out. You know, take your shovel and cut all the way around, lift it out, and then best thing to do would be to take a hose and wash all the soil away from the roots of the blackberry. Most blackberry plants are sold bare root anyway, but it doesn't mean that they're out in the air. They, you know, when the nurseries receive them, they come usually wrapped in some moist material, and then the nurseryman will put them in a pot of perlite or something else to keep the roots moist. So it doesn't hurt to bare root them briefly. So have your new holes in your raised bed dug, or, you know, your soil is probably so soft you can practically scoop it with your hand. But dig your little blackberry plants, take your hose and wash the soil away from the roots of the plant so that you can be absolutely certain you don't have any sprigs of coastal in there, and then just go replant them, water them in with a little Garrett juice, a little Super Thrive, and you'll get growth this year and berries next year.
Wonderful. All right. I will proceed with that. Next question. I go back and forth between pruning my peach trees this time of year. Mm-hmm. And two years ago, I didn't prune, thinking, well, I wasn't getting much fruit anyway, so I'd just let them go, and it didn't seem to make any difference. So I'm going to go back to pruning again. But, man, it gets frustrating to go all that work and not get any peaches. They've got a red skin and a harvester. They both take 750 chilling hours, and I don't know. Is there anything else I can do besides...
move a little further north. Where are you located?
North of New Braunfels, about 8 miles.
Yeah, the winters we've had, even though we've had some severe cold, getting to 10 degrees doesn't do a fruit tree any more good than getting to 41 degrees. The chill hours, once it gets below that 45 degree mark, we start counting chill hours, but it doesn't increase if it gets, is substantially colder. It doesn't do the plants any additional good. So we've actually had relatively warm winters the past two or three years. It's just we've had some periods of, very cold in between, but I doubt you've gotten 750 hours of real chilling weather. In the past two or three years, at least. This year started off pretty good, because we weren't, bitterly cold, but we were cold enough that, this may actually turn out to be a pretty good year for the fruit trees. But if you really want to get peaches, I'd plant a June Gold, I'd plant a La Feliciana, I'd plant a, John Fannick peach, I'd plant a Sam Houston. You're talking Fredericksburg peaches that you've planted, and, that's one thing that's really holding you back from good production. And I think, if you're going to plant one more tree, plant a June Gold. It's a clingstone peach, but boy, it's a delicious peach and it's a heavy producer. And you might even plant a Sam Houston too. Sam Houston's down to, I believe, about 550 hours. In some years, it's going to bloom too early, but a lot of years, it's going to be the best producing tree in your orchard. But, back to the pruning question, keep in mind that pruning is kind of a misnomer. Pruning involves going through and selectively removing growth, usually sometimes some fairly major limbs. And that's what we do the first couple of years that you have your peach trees in the ground, because you were wanting to develop, the overall shape of the tree. But what we do, on an annual basis would more be described as thinning. It's a lot more laborious, but what you're doing is going up and down the stems that you've, or the branches that you've allowed to develop, and taking off like every other one of the little growths that's coming out from it, the little growths that would normally produce buds and peaches, so that you're actually thinning the tree out by 40 to 50%. You're not really going through and pruning. You're not taking out any major limbs. You're not even taking out any limbs that are, as big as your little finger. You're going through and thinning out the smaller growth that's coming out up and down those limbs. And you're just letting the tree, it's got to bloom. It's got to set the peach to begin with. But once that happens, through your thinning, you're going to ensure that the peaches that develop are going to be much larger. You're not going to get as many peaches, but the peaches that you do harvest are going to be a lot more meat and a lot less pit in the middle of it. So keep in mind what you're doing is really thinning, not really pruning, but this is certainly the ideal time of year to do that before the buds really start to swell.
Okay.
But cut your trees back to, you know, something in the 600-650-hour range, and who knows what's going to happen with crazy weather, but 750-800 hours, the varieties you've selected are just, they're going to be an awful lot of years. They don't get adequate chilling to bloom well, and without the blooms, nothing you do is going to give you peaches.
I understand that. Last question. I planted a Warren pear last year, mm-hmm. and it made through the triple-digit heat and drought. And does right. that variety take some kind of a requirement of chilling hours?
No. No. Pears are apples and peaches are the only two things that we can really assign a certain number of chilling hours. Pears, you've got to have a bit of, cooler, colder weather, but we choose pears based on their blight resistance rather than any reference to chilling hours. Warren is a good pear, but keep in mind that with all pears, you absolutely have to have cross-pollination, so you've got to have more than one pear out there, but, you know, Warren's a good, dependable tree, probably live 100 years for you if you take care of it.
Great. Well, with all this glorious rain we've gotten, it ought to be pretty easy to go out there and do my berry project this morning. So I thank you for your wisdom. You have a great day.
Well, it's my great pleasure. And your raised beds are definitely free of coastal or any other form of Bermuda?
Yes, sir.
Very good. It'll work to keep it that way because too many people see just a few little sprigs coming up and think, oh, that's not going to hurt anything. And, you know, all of a sudden you've got a major issue as you discovered. And I guess the good news is that other than the fact that the coastal will steal some nutrients and steal some moisture, you can still grow good berries in and among coastal Bermuda, but it certainly isn't as attractive, and it's certainly a whole lot easier to work your plants without it. So, yeah, get some good, support them with whatever kind of trellis. I use the old so-called cattle panels or hog wire, whatever you want to call it, is what I have on the behind my blackberries, and makes it easy to keep the plants really upright, makes the berries a lot easier to pick, but also it's not too terribly hard to go back through and do the thinning out that you need to do after your plants are through producing. You've probably grown blackberries long enough to know that once you're through with production, you pretty much go through and want to cut out all the canes that have produced berries that year and let the newer canes coming out produce berries the following year.
Yes, and they are delicious.
They are delicious, and they are thorny, but I'll put up with the thorns for some good blackberries anytime. I grew up eating what my grandfather called deep dish blackberry cobbler, and I came away with many scratched hands from picking along the roadsides of East Texas, but sure worth the effort.
Absolutely.
Well, you get out and enjoy this weekend, and I appreciate the call this morning. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, my friend. Bye-bye.
My pleasure always. Thank you. I don't have a lot of time before our 6 o'clock news break. Grab one of those open lines. You know the number, 210-599-5555. It is time to get out and thin on your peach trees, on your plum trees. Plums you thin out even more heavily than you do your peaches. Do not thin pear trees. Do not thin apple trees. That creates a very soft, succulent growth that can lead to some bacterial fire blight problems, and it can really shorten the life of the tree. So remember, we do prune heavily or thin heavily on peaches and plums, then grapes very heavily as well, but put the pruning shears away when it comes to most of the other fruit trees that you may have growing out there. Good time. I'm getting a lot of people asking, can you plant strawberries this time of year? Yes, you can plant strawberries this time of year, but the prime time to plant strawberries is October, November, so that you have a better established plant. You can plant strawberries this late in the year, but you're going to not have nearly as much production as you would have gotten if you planted them a little bit earlier. It most definitely is time to plant onions. I get your onions in the ground as soon as you can if you haven't already planted them. Seed potato or potatoes, not sweet potatoes, but your other potatoes. If you're south of San Antonio, you're probably okay to plant. North San Antonio and certainly up in the hill country. About 2 weeks away is my general recommendation on planting the potatoes, simply because you were likely to have another frost or two or three, and potatoes are very frost sensitive. They'll freeze back to the ground. They can do that once or twice once they're up and growing and still come out and, you know, give you a good crop of potatoes, but if they freeze back repeatedly, you're going to be disappointed in the results. So if you're in the hill country, if you're, you know, far north San Antonio, put it off till sometime around Valentine's Day. And Valentine's Day, by the way, is when we prune bush roses. Talk about that later here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
And as always, we seem to have some open lines available early in the show. When it gets a little bit later, everybody starts getting up. Sometimes you get a lot of busy signals and a lot longer wait. So if you got a good question or gosh, you just want to ask about something that's going on in your garden or your yard or whatever, you know the number, 210-599-5555. Right now, we say good morning to Roy.
Good morning, Bob. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. How about yourself? I was talking about you earlier this week. If this is Roy, I think it is. Some of your friends out at Ferguson said to say hello to you.
Oh, well, good. Okay, yeah, it's right one. I didn't know they still remembered me or not.
Well, I asked. I was in there looking for a cartridge that they didn't have, but I said, have you been around here to remember when Roy ran the show back here? And they said, oh, yeah, you ever talked to him? And so, anyway, they just said, tell you your friends there in the distribution area said hello to you.
Well, I know they still think about me. That's good. And I'm really loving the rain we've got here recently. Boy, it's nice. I don't know what we got last night. I'm guessing around an inch or so, but, you know, that's great, you know.
Well, Clint's not too far from you, and I think he said he got an inch and a half last night. So bring it on. You know, we're getting moisture for the soil. Now we just need to put some water in the lakes and rivers, and I'm thankful for every drop that falls. But you guys have been blessed with more than those of us in the hill country, but it's a good thing for everybody.
Sure is. Bob, have a problem with a mountain laurel.
Uh-huh.
About 10 years old, planted from seed. Mother plant was a deep purple. It finally bloomed last year, and it bloomed white.
Oh,
but
really?
Now, all of a sudden here, a month or so ago, before the freeze, the leaves started turning brown. Some have fallen off, some haven't, and it just looks really bad. There was two or three times last year where it got some worms on it, sort of like a little web worm, sprayed with BT and took care of that. But the thing just looks really, really bad, and I don't know what we need to do to, hopefully it's not dead, but what we need to do to kind of bring it back.
When you look at the branches, when you look at the growth on the mountain laurel, how do the twigs, the branches themselves look? Not the leaves, not the little petiole that comes off, but are the stems, so to speak, are they still good and uniformly green, or do you have big black blotches showing up on them?
I really didn't look at it that close.
Okay.
I haven't, you know, my wife, when we got up this morning, said you need to call and see what you think, so I really don't know. I think they're kind of brown and dark, though, from looking from the distance.
Well, it's when you start seeing that on the branches, it's not a good sign. And when you start getting those little caterpillars, it tells you that the tree's in stress. And Strange as it may seem, Mount Laurels are not nearly as happy south of San Antonio as they are north. And the hot summer was hard on them. And believe it or not, your soils drain so much better than hill country soils do that a lot of Mount Laurels that are planted down there in landscape stayed too dry. And if your soil is like most, you've got, you know, thin, fast-draining soil on top and just a heavy clay layer underneath that. And that's if you plant any more Mount Laurels, Roy, I'd create a raised bed. I'd, you know, try to come up 18 or 20 inches and backfill with, you know, not a black clay, but a much heavier soil that's going to hold the moisture a little bit better. In the meantime, you know, go to Howard's website, dirtdoctor.com, and look up the sick tree treatment. That's going to help. This product called Super Thrive, although the packaging is absolutely crazy on it.
Yeah, and we use it. Yeah, yeah. Like to use it all the time on flowers and stuff, yeah.
Uh-huh. But use it as a foliar spray, you know, on that Mount Laurel. And just be really sure, you know, they grow wild on my ranch up in the hill country, but I've got a much heavier soil and it tends to retain moisture much better. If you go 3 weeks without a good rain, I would be watering that tree really thoroughly. And I suspect that most of these problems developed, you know, when we were so hot this summer and so dry this past summer, and to some extent the summer before, but just keep in mind that you're not in prime Mount Laurel country. You're always going to struggle a little bit with that tree.
Yeah, where I'm at, I do have a heavy clay soil, a lot of flint rock and stuff, not necessarily where this tree is, but it is all heavy, holds water. Yep. Of course, we were so dry last summer, but I did water it a couple of times. I've got some of the square tanks that hold 250, 300 gallons. Mm-hmm. Fill those and let it just drain where it takes about a day to drain off, you know. So
yep.
For all my trees, I do that. But
right.
I don't know, we'll do the Super Thrive and try to nurse it back to health. Yeah.
And like I say, if you want to plant another one, just create a good raised bed.
Okay.
I had an old cousin that obviously wasn't into the aesthetics of things, but his name was Bubba, appropriately enough. But he would pile up 3 or 4 truck tires and then fill it up with soil, and that's where he planted trees, including, you know, fruit trees and ornamental trees both. And darned if he didn't grow, you know, some of the best trees around, because that was his idea of a raised bed. And there's a lot to be said for raised beds, especially if you're going to try growing a plant that's not real happy in the area that you are. We had a kind of a nurseryman's gathering this past week, and I was telling him about my old friend and mentor that I worked for a couple of years, that and I go see. His name was Alton Grimm, and one of the finest men and probably the finest nurseryman I've ever known. But I go and say, Alton, hey, I just heard about this tree. You know, I think we ought to get some of them and give them a try. And he said, how many of them do you see growing around here? And I said, well, I've never seen one. And he'd just smile and say, well, you know, there's probably a reason for that. And so
yeah.
It's fun to grow some things, but sometimes you've really got to go to extremes to be able to give them the conditions they like. And like I say, I think you probably do okay with Mount Laurel in a raised bed, but you're going to struggle with it. You'll probably keep it alive. Now, had the tree bloomed purple before and then it just switched to white, or had it ever bloomed well for you before?
No, it didn't bloom at all until last year. Last year was the first time it bloomed, and it bloomed white. Yeah.
Well, there are white Mount Laurels. They're not real common. There's even a pink Mount Laurel. I once went through a tree at a big field at a professional grower, and you know, they probably had 500 Mount Laurels in bloom, and I picked out a white one and picked out a pink one and took home and planted in my front yard. So, you know, you have a tree worth protecting and growing. Much as I hate to say it, many times white flowers are not quite as strong as some of the more brightly colored flowers as far as the plants themselves. But Mount Laurels, they're not rare, but they're not common. So you've got a special tree. Do your best to bring it through.
Okay, we will, yeah. I have one more question, Bob.
Yes, sir.
I have a terrible problem with nut sedge, or I call it nut scourge, in my garden.
Okay.
And I've tried putting molasses on there some, but maybe I just haven't followed up or done it enough. But I guess my question is, I'll plant my tomatoes and put a lot of molasses around there. Can I do too much where it makes where it gets the soil too rich or whatever, if you will, where the tomatoes won't do it good?
No, it would be hard to overuse. I mean, I wouldn't overdo it. But you could probably put it, you know, just sprinkle a heavy, you know, layer of either dry molasses, or as long as you are diluting it down, it's a very good thing for your tomatoes. And next year, I mean, we're getting pretty darn close to tomato planting season, as hard as that is to believe.
Right,
but
yeah.
Next year, if you don't have anything growing in there over the winter months, that's when you want to really make your molasses in a concentrated form, like half a cup per gallon of water. I think that would be a little too strong on the tomatoes, but you could certainly go up to a couple of tablespoons, two or three tablespoons per gallon, and in fact, your tomatoes are going to like it at that point. The other thing, and it's tough to do, but definitely keep things on the drier side. And once your tomatoes are up and growing, they'll be happy with that. They don't need to be watered as frequently as long as you're watering them deeply. But nut sedge loves wet soil, and the more you water, the faster that stuff's going to grow and spread. So if you can't help what nature does, but try to allow those plants to dry just as much as you can. You grow better tomatoes that way, actually. But when in doubt, keep the soil on the dry side rather than the moist side where you're fighting nut sedge. And it doesn't really hurt the plants. I mean, it does cause some problems with potatoes where that little blasted sharp growth will actually grow through the potato. But tomatoes and peppers and eggplant and things like that, it doesn't seem to have much influence at all on the growth. It just doesn't look real pretty.
Yeah, it makes it hard to do a berm around them and everything, you know, because it's so thick. But I will do that, and I appreciate the information, Bob. As always, nice talking to you, and you have a great day.
You do the same. One other thing, Roy. Keep the area fairly heavily mulched. I had a rose bed at one point that I had a nut sedge problem with, and I put like 3 inches of mulch on the surface of that one spring, and it's like the nut sedge just kind of rose up in the soil and started making all of its new growth up within the top half inch of mulch, and I could go through there and pull out the mother plant, and I get 8 little plants around it every time I did. And by really keeping after that for 3 months in the spring, I totally eliminated the nut sedge from that flower bed. So where you can, mulch heavily, and then you're going to find that the nut sedge is going to start producing all the new little plantlets are going to be way up high in the mulch. And it sure does make it easier to where you're trying to pull it out. You can get a lot of them out, you know, with every one that you pull.
Okay, will do, Bob.
You have a good day. And thank you. Appreciate the call, Roy. Thank you. Bye. All right, let's talk for a minute about nature's creation, and let's talk about some different kinds of weeds, those things that tend to start sprouting up this time of year. And a lot of people want to fight those weeds with what we call a pre-emergent herbicide, things that actually keep the plants from developing. I can't say it keeps the seeds from sprouting, but it keeps the seeds from forming a root system, and then as it stays dry, they just kind of fold up and die. The problem is that all the synthetic pre-emergents tend to be very hard on your trees and your other plants. Plus, in my opinion, they're dangerous toxic chemicals. There is one natural pre-emergent herbicide, and it's called corn gluten meal. And Nature's Creation makes it in a spreadable form, something you can put on with a fertilizer spreader, which makes it very easy to apply. Now, it's not going to be 100%, but let me tell you what, it works just as well as the toxic synthetic chemicals, and it'll go a long way toward reducing your problems. Plus, has a lot of nitrogen in it. It actually serves as a good fertilizer. Nature's Creation makes a lot of fine products, natural products, many of them fully organic, many of them certified organic, and that includes things like your spreadable corn gluten meal. again, from Nature's Creation. Check out their other fine products as well, including their good fertilizers. If you're looking for a good slow-release fertilizer to put out this time of year, check out their lawn and garden food with no manures in it whatsoever. It's based on alfalfa and some naturally good other nitrogen sources. Just remember, Nature's name, Nature's Creation, stands for quality. You'll find them wherever fine nursery and other garden products are sold. Nature's Creation, spreadable corn gluten meal.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening on a nice Saturday morning out there. It looks like most of the rain has moved out of the area. I think most people got at least half an inch around the area overnight, and that's a great follow-up to the heavier rains we had 10 days or so ago. So it's a good thing. Haven't had to do much watering in the past month or so, and this'll keep us going for another week or 10 days. And put a little sunshine on top of that moisture, and you're going to see all sorts of buds swelling and things starting to grow. I believe James is next in line and on the phone bank. So good morning, James.
Morning, Bob. How you doing?
Well, I'm good this morning. You know, a good rain is always welcome, and this was a good one. You know, I had lightning and thunder in with it, so got a little bit of nitrogen fixed in the air, and none of that severe stuff they were saying was a possibility. So it's a good thing.
Did you check your rain gauge before you headed to town this morning?
0.62. And it was still raining lightly, so it may have gotten a little bit more. But for us hill country people, anything over half an inch of rain is pretty good rain. So that made me smile. I was honestly thinking, I didn't hear it raining real heavily too much during the night, so I was expecting to find about 4 tenths, but to find over 6 tenths was a pleasant surprise.
That's great. I looked out the door this morning, and judging by the lake on the front yard, we got at least two and a half inches.
Yeah. I've talked to some people down south of town that got that kind of rain. So, it was a good steady rain with occasionally, you know, a little kind of what my grandfather used to call a cloudburst, where it really came down hard. So a lot of folks waking up to good moisture this morning.
That's great. We're starting to top the pepper plants in the greenhouse. They're getting about 8 to 9 inches tall, and they're getting about the right size. They're starting to branch, and then once they branch up top, then you cut them back an inch or so, and it'll keep the plant in a little bit better growing condition. Last year, I didn't prune my peppers, and some of those branches on those jalapenos got 3 foot long, man.
What is your favorite jalapeno? What variety? I'm sure it's probably one of Johnny's, but do you have a favorite on the jalapenos?
Oh, yeah. We've been growing the Jedi for about 7 years, I guess.
Ah.
Very good. It's a really good producer, good and hot, like everybody likes. I'm trying some Jalafuegos this year for big monster peppers, but that Jedi, you can't beat it. It's got real good hybrid vigor, and it's a real good plant.
And you said Jalafuego for a big jalapeno. Somebody was asking me the other day what was going to be one of the biggest jalapenos they could plant. That's another one that's new to me. Is that from Johnny's?
Yes, sir. Johnny's got the Jalafuego.
Yeah, very good. Well, you plant yourself at least a few shishitos. I think if you grow some of that little pepper, it'll quickly become one of your new favorites, because it's hot enough to get your attention, as my old buddy used to say, to have some authority. But that's the nicest little plant that you don't have to trim back. It's only going to grow maybe 18 inches tall, and I've gone out and picked 20, 30 peppers at a time off a single plant. So it ought to be something you got in your rotation.
That's good advice. I grow a pepper from Mexico. It's I call it a tree chili. They'll get 5-6 foot tall, and they really need to be topped when they're small, so that so they'll stay at a manageable height. It's just a real big chili topine is what it is.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that's the way some of the your peppers that they use for making the chili rellenos, they make a big, tall pepper like that. In fact, I grow those in a tomato cage because they get so tall. And you get a little wind, you get a little bit of rain, it kind of beats them up. And does this one have a strong trunk, or is this another one that needs some support?
Well, if you don't top them, they need sticks or bamboo sticks or cages or whatever. They get pretty tall. But if you top them when they're small, they stay a little bit more manageable. But they'll get, oh man, they'll get a trunk on them an inch and a half, 2 inches in diameter, and I call them chili trees. They're monster.
Yeah, I bet you pick a lot of, if they're little peppers like the bird peppers, I bet you pick a lot of peppers off one of those.
Yeah, man, they produce. We're starting to get into the season when it's time to put down nematodes.
We put them down a couple of days ago, as a matter of fact.
There's a, I guess you call it a pupa from the corn earworm that that is sometimes manageable with nematodes. Is that right?
Oh, the nematodes, very definitely. It's actually, you know, there's a larval state and then a pupal state. The larval state is what we've got out there right now. And if you got the right mix of beneficial nematodes, it'll knock them out, and it will take care even on some of the your moths that make the borers. From my opinion, it's a really good time to get some beneficial nematodes out, and just be sure you've got the right blend. There are hundreds of kinds of beneficial nematodes, and there are over 500,000 different kinds of nematodes when you throw in all the ones that are bad plus ones they don't really know what they do. So there are an awful lot of different ones, and we get this mix they call Guardian Lawn Patrol. It's got 6 or 7 different strains of nematodes in there, including the ones that get most of those larvae. So pay attention and read the label on what you're putting out. Just be sure you're getting a nematode that'll control the problems that you want to control, because they're not all of them. All of them will control something good or bad, but the gardener wants to have a good blend. You're not nearly as concerned, you know, about fleas and ticks and grub worms as a homeowner is out in the garden. You want things that are going to take care of the garden pests. So check the blend of nematodes you're getting to really get the best results.
And who are you getting these from?
Well, they used to be called Hydro Gardens. They were in Colorado Springs. They've moved to Oregon now, and I think it's called Nature's Control or something like that. But they do more than one blend. We get the one called Guardian Lawn Patrol, and that's one that I find does the very best to control a wide range of problems.
And what's that name again, Bob?
The name of the company?
Yes.
I believe it's not Nature's Creation, but it's like Nature's Garden or something like that. I'll have to go look. This is relatively, it's just within the past year that they made the big move and changed the name. I believe it's, let me look it up for you, James. I'll find it for you. I think it's called Nature's Control, I think, is what it is.
Nature's Control. We're putting the nematodes in the compost tea and then putting them out with the hose, and it works really well. I'm getting my compost. It's a compost and worm casting mix from Luke out at Compost Tea Labs.
Right.
It's got everything in it, man, for making some really good compost.
Well, that sounds good. And just you know this, but for the benefit of our other listeners, if you're going to add beneficial nematodes to your compost tea, make it the last thing you put in, because those little nematodes can drown if they stay, you know, in liquid for too long. So you don't want to put them in early in the tea making process. You want to make the last thing you put in before you go spray your tea out, and that'll ensure you get the biggest number of good live nematodes out there.
Yeah, take out all your filters, like, you know, and the hose in sprayer and all your,
right,
any filters you might have, and you're in pretty good shape. Compost Tea Lab's got a really, really good compost mix that makes some really nice tea. All you got to do is add molasses and or fish powder.
Right. Well, compost tea is great. It's a lot of people confuse compost tea and compost leachate, and even compost leachate is good. But if you're making a good, what Dr. Ingham calls actively aerated compost tea, AACT, yeah, Compost Tea Labs has some great things to be using as the base for that. And the other thing that I always try to tell people that are wanting to get into making compost tea is keep your brewer where it's going to be at ambient temperature, because you're going to get a whole different range of microbes, both the beneficial bacteria and fungi and microarthropods and everything else. You're going to get a different blend depending on whether your water is cold or, you know, medium or hot. So just be sure your water's pretty much matching your air temperature, so you're going to get the microbes that are most active at that point.
Yeah, Compost Tea Labs has a recipe card, and it's got all the brewing temperatures and how long it takes at the different temperatures and all the additives, and it's really a good recipe card to have.
Yeah. And like you say, they've got the things that go into the compost tea. There are a couple of good companies. The folks up in Oregon make a pretty good material to use as a base. But you know, I always tell people, throw in a little compost out of your own garden, because those homegrown microbes are awfully important to get into the mix as well.
Can I call you back later and get the name of that company?
Sure. Sure. It's and if I'm not around, ask for Wendy or Donna, or they're the ones that usually write the check when we get them in, but you're more than welcome to. Saturdays and Sundays, I'm here at the nursery pretty much all day long.
Oh, that sounds great. Okay, Bob, well, thanks for taking my call and answering all my questions.
Well, it's always a pleasure visiting with you, James. We always learn from you as well, so get out and get those tomatoes topped back, and or your peppers rather topped back, and get everything going, because hard to believe that it's, you know, barely a month from now we're going to be putting a lot of that stuff out in the garden. And it's, I know a lot of gardeners are going to be a little behind because we're still getting some chilly weather, but growing your own stuff from seed and really getting it up to a good point is you better be working on it right now. So you keep us informed what you're up to, and we'll learn from you.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, James. We'll talk again. All right, let's get a break in here, and I get to talk to you for a moment about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center. And Fanix is just, I don't know, they're known for a lot of things. They're such a big nursery, oldest nursery in San Antonio, over 10 acres of ground, which gives them room to have a lot of different things. And everybody's so interested, seems like people are getting back into fruit trees, and nobody has a better selection than Fanix. And they've got some real novelties, too. They've got the multiple grafted trees. They've got peaches and plums, both of which you know, have four different varieties of peaches or four different varieties of plums grafted all onto one tree. Now, that pretty much takes care of your cross-pollination issues. Plus, it's just fun. You'll have a slightly different productive season, so you're picking ripe fruit over a longer period of time. Just leave it to Fanix to come up with some really unusual and different things as well. Of course, they have plenty of just your standard fruit trees, plenty of berries. They've gotten their seed potatoes in. They've got onions. Fanix is just well stocked, as they always are. They've got citrus. They've got a wide range of cool weather vegetables. It's just always fun to go visit. They've got those shade trees, too, if you're going to take advantage of the CPS Energy Green Tree Shade Rebate Program this year, where they'll give you up to $50 credit for every tree you plant, as long as they go in an area that's going to shade your home. Just a lot of different things. And keep in mind, too, the Fanix also has Traeger pellet grills and all the accessories. Plus, they've got the Eco lithium-ion battery-powered outdoor equipment. Just lots of reasons to go to Fanix. Check out their website, too. They've got a downloadable garden calendar, and you keep up with all the events since they're celebrating, I believe, 85 years this year. They're going to have an expanded seminar schedule, and you'll find all that information at Fanix, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanixNursery.com, located over on Home Green Road, where they've been for 85 years.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening, and let's get straight back to the phone lines. Looks like it's going to be Anthony and John are my next two callers. Anthony's first in line. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning, Bob. Great to talk to you.
My pleasure. What can I do this morning?
Well, I haven't talked to you in a long time. I'm here in Pleasanton, and I've got a yard, Floritam St. Augustine.
Yeah.
And back in May of 2021, I talked to you, and I've gotten some compost from the company down here on the south side, closer to Pleasanton. I'm not going to say their names, but anyway, I put 16 yards out. And then got busy and didn't get to fertilize like I normally do.
Mm-hmm.
But so I got some of your your essentials fertilizer that I
always
get from you.
We call it landscape. Yeah, landscape essentials. It's just an enhanced growing green from Medina. Medina and add a few extra things to it. But yeah, we call it landscape essentials.
Landscape essentials. I put that out probably at the early fall of this year, and then I noticed about September, October, my yard started to thin out, and it was just getting thinner and thinner, and I didn't understand what's going on. I thought, well, maybe I put out too much compost back in May of 2021, but I think if that would have been a problem, it would have showed up quicker. But now, since we had the real bad cold snap here, I mean, I have just about lost my entire yard, the turf. Even some of the runners are dying, but it's just my entire yard. It's not just one area. It's the entire yard I'm losing to where it's nothing but dirt now.
That's the cold, and that's the one drawback to Floritam. It was developed as a coastal grass, and they've almost stopped planting it up in the Metroplex area, Dallas-Fort Worth, after the cold winters. I think you're going to be surprised. A lot of it will come back. But and if you put down that much compost in 2021, you probably don't have to do it this year. A thin top dressing would be good, but if you haven't fertilized in the last 3 months, you know, I most definitely would.
Well, I did. I put yours out.
Oh, okay.
It was either September or October. I put three bags out.
Well, it's about time to do it again. You know, that carries you through and into early spring, but here we're in February, so we're 4 months out from that. So especially where your yard's struggling a little bit, be good to put a little more on sometime in the next month or 6 weeks. But beyond that,
I started noticing it before the cold weather, Bob. It started getting thin in areas, and I didn't understand why, where you could even, like right now, I can't even walk around in the mornings when the dew's out without getting my shoes totally muddy on my yard anywhere.
Oh,
you
wow.
So I'm concerned. I don't know if Brown Patch would have done that. I've got the county extension agent. He's going to come by next week or this coming week, and we're going to get some soil samples I'm going to send off. But, I mean, I don't know what else to do.
Well, a couple of things.
I spent $250 a month on water all through the summer.
Oh, I know. It was a bad summer. Thinning out in the fall is most commonly due to, you know, that late season batch of grub worms. And we saw a lot of grubs in the fall. It's relatively easy to identify their damage if you get out and actually lift up on the runners. You'll find where there are a lot of nodes that are, you know, missing their roots. If you're going to do soil samples, don't let them send them to A&M. A&M, does a totally different extraction method, and they will tell you what's in your soil, but not what's available to your plants. Send your soil samples to Texas Plant and Soil Labs down in Edinburgh. They're no more expensive, and they do a different type of soil test. The way a plant gets it, a plant releases carbon dioxide through its roots, which forms carbonic acid. Carbonic acid acts on the different things that are in the soil and turns them into fertilizer products, you might say, that can be absorbed by the plant. And TPSL, they do a carbonic extraction method. They look at the nutrients the same way the plant does. And so the test that they will give you tells you not just what's in the soil, but what is actually available to the plants. Unless A&M has changed, they're still doing a basic test where they basically dissolve everything that's in there. And sure, they'll tell you how much nitrogen, how much phosphorus, how much potassium, how much iron, but they're not going to be able to tell you how much of the material that's in there is actually available to the plants. And like I say, Texas Plant and Soils Labs just does by far the best test in the business. And they do it for, you know, big time agriculture as well as for homeowners. And they're no more expensive than the other people are. And they just give you a lot more useful information in their soil test.
And how do I get find out where to send it to? Just look them
just,
up?
Yeah, look them up. And if you call down there, you may very well talk to Noe, who's a gentleman that runs the lab, and he'll tell you how to take your sample to. Yeah, Noe, I guess it's probably short for Noel, but Noe Garcia down there, great guy. And he'll tell you how to take your soil samples, because you don't want to get it, you know, right up on the surface of the soil. You want to dig down a little and get the soil down in the area where your grass is trying to grow its roots, and that way you get a lot more accurate soil test. And he can tell you, based on what kind of grass you have and things, exactly how to take that sample and you know, get it off to them. They get back to you pretty quickly. And like I say, I think they charge almost the same thing as A&M does, but they just give you a better test. There's just no other way to put it.
But if I go on, because some of these I have reached down, I pulled on the runners, mm-hmm. that look dead, and they're still attached. So, I mean, could it be brown patch? It took my
it
whole
could,
yard. I wouldn't.
Could be those. Brown patch, but brown patch doesn't usually show up until we get some pretty chilly weather in the fall. And you'll normally identify brown patch if you lift up on little individual blades on your grass. The whole blade, the runner will stay attached to the ground, but the blade pulls away. But brown patch rarely, you know, will kill a whole big area of grass. It'll take out, you'll see a lot of brown areas in there, but there's normally enough runner left behind that it will come out again in the spring. And like I say, brown patch shows up when we have cool nights and warm days. So fall is when we see it most. But if it was early fall, that'd be unusual to have brown patch real early. There's another disease called take-all patch, but that's something that usually shows up in the middle of the summer, June, July. So, and that's what me, just almost as much by process of elimination, makes me think it was probably grubs. But again, without seeing it, it's hard to say.
I get to come look at my yard and get and temp and do a little research?
Well, if you're starting with your county agent, is a good place, because he's, you know, you're paying for it through your taxes. I don't think they make any charge to do that. There's a guy here in San Antonio named Sam Sitterly. You might give Sam a call. I don't know how far out he goes. He's got hundreds, if not thousands, of people here in San Antonio that he does consulting for. If you look him up online, he'll be Green Grow Organics. If you want to call him, his number's 210-599-5565. And he might be able to give you some help over the phone, or he might get you to take some pictures and send them. I don't know if he comes down toward Pleasanton or not. He's pretty busy just up in this area. But he's about the only guy I know that I feel confident, you know, in telling you somebody to come look at grass. David Vaughn is by far the best.
What's his last name?
His name is Sitterly. His dad was a home builder, Sam Sitterly.
Sitterly.
Yeah, okay. Sitterle.
SITTERLE?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll give him a call and see what he does. But I'm also hopefully get the soil sample, and then I'll get with Noe before I get the sample to make sure I'm doing it right.
And get back to me. I want to know. I want to be sure they do a good job for you.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, and we've got plenty of time to take a couple of calls before news. John will be first, and then it'll be Roy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Wondering about the schedule. The rain finally moved out of here in Gonzales. And,
uh-huh.
Another thing that I'm wondering about the schedule on, I saw a purple martin on the 29th of January.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be a purple martin. It was, I guess, a female had the white breast. I mean, the light-colored breast.
Uh-huh.
And then I said, that can't be. It's January. And then the next day I saw a male and a female.
Right. Well, what you're actually seeing, the birding people call them scouts. They're not really scouts. They are the young unmated pairs that are always the first ones to arrive. Normally it's the first or second week in February, but I'm not really surprised. You know, up until this real brief bitter cold, we were relatively warm for January. So, yeah, it's time you could start seeing some of the purple martins arrive. You're not going to see the big numbers of them for another 3 or 4 weeks probably, but the early ones, the so-called scouts, I'm not surprised they're out there.
Well, I remember a couple of years ago, one of the old-timers came in. He had one eye. I found that out because he came in, it was warm, and then the next day that cold air came in, and he just fell off the house. He was cold. He just froze to death. And there's nothing you can feed him. I don't get it.
No. Well, that's a good question. I don't know. Call Kyle out at Wild Birds Unlimited sometime. I think the number is 479-BIRD, if I'm remembering right. And ask him if they're, they're not, martins are not seed eaters. They are insect eaters. And they make some good suet cake material that has mealworms and has, you know, some of the insect things in there. So I don't honestly know if purple martins would go to that or not, but it's the one food out there that would very much benefit them. And if you offer it to them the right way, probably would be good. But that's a great question. I'm writing myself a note to call Kyle and ask that question myself. But I honestly don't know. But I would think that some of the suet cake material would be good for the martins. Whether they will come to it at a feeder, I don't know.
And another thing on schedule, I don't know if it's a wives' tale or folklore, but you've got all kind of theories about Easter and the cold air. And Easter is in March, so everything seems to be a little bit ahead of schedule this year.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well,
anyway.
I'm not necessarily going to do all my planning by it, but, it's interesting to me that the old Farmer's Almanac seems to do a better job than the weathermen do of long-range forecasting, and they sure called it right on the January cold. And my question is, how did they know about it a year in advance when the meteorologists couldn't get it right a week in advance? So there may be something to it. I'll have to check the old Farmer's Almanac and see what they're saying about early spring, but when Easter's late, we definitely typically have later cold. So let's hope with Easter being early that spring arrives a little early too. As long as these good rains keep up, and as long as we don't get super hot just overnight.
Well, if you find out about supplementing purple martin's food, mention it on the radio, and I'll pick it up.
Yeah, I will certainly do it. But if you have a chance, again, Wild Birds Unlimited out there on Northwest Military at Huebner, nice guys. And just give them a call. I'm virtually certain, I'm going from memory, but I think their phone number is, of course, area code 210, but it's 479-BIRD. Pretty easy to remember. Call them and you get the answer a little bit sooner. I'll try to call them in the next couple of days, and I will most certainly put that on the air.
Thanks a lot.
It's my pleasure, John. Thank you. Next in line is Roy. Good morning, Roy.
I think it's Ron. Is that right?
Ron. Okay. Very good, Ron.
Yeah. Bob, I know last week, you know, somebody was talking about smoking chili patines, and I don't know if you've ever heard of a Uvalde smoker. It got its name because it was first, you see them, they're very big and heavy. They're made, I think they weld them with pipe, like transmission pipe.
Sounds like a good Texas smoker.
Well, several people make them. They call them Uvalde smokers, and they're very heavy. I mean, they're, I don't know, thousands of pounds probably.
Oh, wow.
My point is that there's a firebox on one side, so you can grill, you know, steak or chicken. Uh-huh. Then next to that is another large chamber where you would barbecue, and it has a thermometer on it, so it tells you, is it 250, 350, is it broiling temperature or smoking temperature? Uh-huh. And then there's a large chimney next to that that would be smoking, for smoking. And I've made like venison jerky and stuff like that in that. So I don't know. I'm just, for somebody who's interested in a combination of a griller, a barbecue pit, so to speak, and a smoker, that's what you want to get. They come in different sizes.
Uh-huh. Are they set up so that in your smoking area, you know, if you're really going to smoke something well, you need to put some sort of chip. Some people like mesquite. I like applewood chips. We've smoked a lot of trout that way, and let me tell you, that's better than anything you're going to find in any restaurant in town.
Oh, yeah.
But is it
set up for a
place to add your chips, soak your chips in water, and then throw them on the coals?
That would be in the firebox.
Uh-huh.
Even though that's not under the air you're smoking, that smoke travels through the smoker, through the smoker to get to there. So you would put that on whatever wood, whether you're using charcoal or mesquite or oak or whatever, pecan, you would put that to create the smoke. You do it in the firebox.
Huh. And it's called Uvalde smoker is the name of it?
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
I'll have to look
Uvalde
at that.
Smoker. Yeah. And then a completely different subject. I'm 81 years old. I grew up in a small town, Quero.
Uh-huh.
And if a fruit or a vegetable wasn't in season, you didn't buy it. Now you can go into HEB. And here's going to be my question. But you can go into HEB and you can buy strawberries, you know, 365. You can buy fresh corn with, you know, still in the shucks. You can buy anything, you know, blueberries, blackberries, whatever. The only thing that's seasonal probably would be Texas grapefruit and Pecos cantaloupe. Those are seasonal. But my question is, a lot of these things, like I bought some organic strawberries. I buy organic if I can.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and it says they're grown in Mexico. Now, who's overseeing the people growing these fruits and vegetables all over the world and calling them organic? How do we know they're organic?
Well, that's a real good question, and I have a lot of questions about that too. There are different companies that certify things organic, different organizations. USDA is sort of the standard of that, and supposedly they have people that go out and inspect anywhere that's going to, you know, label their material as organic. I think Oregon Tilth is a better organization. There's something called the GMO Project, which also is a very good organization. But there's a lot of question about that. Listen, if you can hang on for just a second, I've got to get to news. We can talk a little bit more. This is KTSA Radio San Antonio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
And we do have a few open lines, so it'll be a great time to dial. Getting close to that time when the sun comes up and everybody starts trying to get through, and then you end up on hold for a longer period of time. So got a question, comment, whatever, pick up the phone, call me right now, 210-599-5555. We're just going to throw on about overseas produce coming in, and supposedly, you know, USDA, I don't know whether they pay local people to monitor it, but the reason we, you know, we have so many different fruits and vegetables available is just because they're flown in from all over the world. I don't know how they do it economically, but a lot of our produce this time of year comes out of New Zealand, believe it or not. A lot of it comes out of South America, so it would be an interesting question to ask, but I'm not real sure who we would ask. But supposedly it is monitored. I'm sure it's better than nothing, but I like you, I don't trust it 100%. But if you're shopping somewhere like Natural Grocers or Whole Foods, isn't nearly as good as they used to be, but there are some places that do try to keep an eye on things. And believe it or not, stuff coming out of Italy is some of the cleanest material you will find. Those people, I know recently, they actually turned away a whole shipload of oats because they found Roundup residue in it, and they wouldn't let them land it in the country. So some places are undoubtedly better than others. And I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No. You've made a good explanation of my question. And actually, I'm just, while we were listening to the news, I got the strawberries out of the refrigerator, and they're Driscoll's, and it does say USDA organic, even though it comes from Mexico. So I'm just assuming someone goes down there. But I knew a person who grew, what was it called, rapeseed in England.
Uh-huh.
And somebody came out from the government, and it was supposed to be organic, but it wasn't really organic. He said, I'm gonna give you the organic okay. So I'm just thinking, somebody crosses their palm with some some cash, they might just call it organic when it's not. I mean,
especially south of our own border.
It's Mordida.
Yeah, that's what they call it. But it would be interesting. The problem is it would be very expensive. They can test. There are companies out there that can test for, pesticide residues, and that sort of thing can be monitored. But USDA actually has some pretty good standards that supposedly people have to follow as far as what kind of fertilizers they use, as well as what kind of sprays and things. And like you, I'm not sure how much they do, but occasionally you will see things certified by an organization called Oregon Tilth. T-I-L-T-H, they're a whole lot better even than USDA about monitoring things. The organization known as the GMO Project, they don't deal with soils and sprays and things like that, but they very definitely deal with the genetics of the deal, whether there's genetically modified material in there or not. Their symbol's kind of a little butterfly that you'll see. Probably, you'll see it oftentimes in conjunction with that USDA seal, but I trust them probably more than I do, USDA, at least as far as being GMO-free. If it says USDA certified organic, it's supposed to be 100% free of GMOs and supposed to be grown only with non-biosolid organic fertilizers, and those are important things to me as well.
Yeah, I agree. And since I have you on the phone, when do you get your first tomato plants in at Shades of Green?
Probably next week. The growers we keep asking for them earlier and earlier because there are a lot of people like to take them and pot them up and grow them out a little bit further. I'll have to check with Wendy over here, but I wouldn't be at all surprised to see some show up next week.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bob. I appreciate your time and your wisdom. Thank you.
Well, it's always a pleasure. I really appreciate the call and the good questions. That's, there's just so many thought-provoking things out there and so many good people out there that answer those questions that a few tens of thousands of other people would like the answers to. let's see here. Don, do we have anybody else on hold right this second? Got Bob and Kathy. All right, Bob's first in line then. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
I have a question for you. Is it time to cut down the fire bushes?
Absolutely.
Or the firecracker?
The fire bush freezes to the ground every winter, and it's going to be the slowest perennial in your garden to come out again. I always tell people that the firebush, Himalaya is its botanical name, it always comes out 2 weeks after you give up on it. When you think it's not coming back, it will come back. It's one of the most cold-hardy perennials out there. But yes, the top is totally frozen. You might as well go ahead and cut it back. Just, you know, put a little mound of compost or something so you won't forget where it is and accidentally dig it up. But I would cut back. Actually, I would cut back anything that is obviously frozen. The things that we pretty much count on coming back are the firebush, the lantanas. Many of the salvias freeze down. A few of them, like Salvia greggii, are evergreen. The so-called firecracker is a plant called Roselia, and it sometimes comes back, it sometimes doesn't. If it was covered or if it was mulched, it probably will come back out, but you might as well go ahead and cut it back. Everything from about an inch or two up is definitely frozen, unless it was covered, and then in some cases probably only partially froze. But if it looks, you know, brown and dead, go ahead and cut it back, because that tissue is. Now, the only other exception I can really think of, and it's not widely grown, but there are some clematis vines that a few people grow successfully. Those things look so dead you would swear that they're totally and completely gone, and yet they will come out gangbusters as soon as we get a little bit of warm weather.
Well, I'm going to take it. This is probably a fire bush that I have, because it came back after the bad freeze back a couple of years ago, and I cut it back because I'd heard you, but I only cut it. I left about 6 or 8 inches sticking up. Mm-hmm. How far above ground should I cut that?
Maybe an inch. It doesn't really matter.
Okay.
Because where it comes out is actually going to be right below the surface of the ground. But it doesn't really matter. You can let it start coming out and then go back and, you know, cut off the rest of the top of it, or you can go ahead and do it now. If the weather stays, well, if the weather stays such that the soil temperature warms up, things like lantana, things like, you know, your salvia farinacea and indigo spires and mystic spires, all those, you're likely to see buds swelling and coming out within the next couple of weeks. But like I say, your firebush, don't look for it to be coming back till Easter, but it will come back.
Right. It was real slow on coming back this last year.
And every year.
When do you get them in?
Typically, when we get to around, you know, when we feel like we're not going to have another freeze. That's sometimes a little hard to judge. Most years, it's going to be early March. Somebody wants them, we can usually get some of them from our growers earlier than that. But most of the perennials, you know, the deciduous perennials, they start looking for them around the first week or two of March.
Okay, that'll work, because I'm going to put some more out. I finally got a hummingbird coming to this one. I don't do feeders because I'm lazy sometimes, and I work a lot. And I don't want to hurt the birds, but I want to have them something for them here.
Well, the things like that are very good, not to mention butterflies and bees and other things like that. There are some beautiful perennials that you can plant right now. Salvia greggii is one of those that, in fact, you'll probably find those in full bloom. And hummingbirds aren't back yet, but that's always one of their favorite plants when they are back with its tubular flowers. They come in a lot of colors, and I wouldn't hesitate to plant those right now. I don't think I would hesitate to plant the trailing lantanas. I wouldn't plant the bush forms yet, but the trailing forms are a little bit more cold hardy. And, the Salvia leucantha, the Mexican bush sage, I think you're fine to plant. If you're just looking for some pretty flowers to put out, you can definitely find it. But a lot of things, I'd sure wait a couple of weeks before you start setting them out.
Okay, well, me and the wife are going to have to make a trip your way one of these days. I'm over here in Moulton, Texas,
sure,
south of Flatonia.
Right.
And
well, if you're
I've
ever this way.
Several times.
Yeah, just come wander through. Nobody has to buy anything to be welcome. You know, we get compared to the botanical garden fairly often because we don't look like a nursery. We look much more like a big garden. And love to have people come, and the thing that flatters us most, we have lots of folks that say, I just come here because it makes me feel good. So when you come in this way, be sure and stop in.
Oh, we'll do it. I'm sure with the wife, there will definitely be something bought. I look forward to it.
I jokingly tell people the difference in us and the botanical garden is at the botanical garden, you pay to get in. Here you pay to get out. But
exactly.
It's not necessary. Always enjoyable, but not necessary. So you get out and have a good day and take good care of those hummingbirds. By the way, there is a product. I haven't tried it yet because our hummingbirds empty the feeders so fast. We're always, you know, refilling. But Wild Birds Unlimited has a product you can add to the nectar. It's a good thing, especially early in the season and late in the season when you don't have very many hummingbirds, that helps that nectar stay fresh longer.
Yeah, so well, I just got married this last October.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And she'll be a lot better at that than I will. We'll probably put out a few feeders this year.
Well, you enjoy it, and you get a lot more hummingbirds if you put out more than one feeder and do kind of spread them out a little bit, because you'll get, especially the ruby throat, you'll get one little male that wants to try to dominate the feeder and not let anybody else drink. But put out two or three feeders and spread them out a bit. I love it, because it just frustrates the heck out of those little guys, because they waste all their energy trying to guard all three feeders, and the girls are sneaking in behind them at whichever one they're not guarding. So anyway, you and your new bride enjoy it, and I appreciate your call this morning. Thanks for calling from Bolton.
All right. You have a good day.
You too, sir. Thank you. Bye. All right. Kathy, hang on just a minute because we need to get a break in here. Don, I don't have a live at this point. Let's run the recording and get back to questions.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to the gardening and back to the phone lines. It's going to be Kathy and JT and Augie. Kathy's first in line. Good morning, Kathy. Hi, Kathy, are you there? Donna, we got...
I'm right here, yes.
Okay, very good. Good morning.
Thank you. Yeah, it's the best time to talk to you at the when it's still dark outside.
Well, it's getting to be daylight now, and that means the phones start getting busy. But I'm glad to talk to you. How can I help?
I have two questions, and I've always rattled around. I'm the one trying very hard keeping the orchids alive. I can grow anything outside. The things inside, good luck. And I have managed to... Somebody gave me another one. She didn't know any better. She gave it to me in April. Lots of flowers, little tiny pot. And I learned the ice cube trick. Three ice cubes every Monday, and it kept it, I think, properly watered. I've got a lot of leaves, and now the stem where the flowers were is turning brown. And what do I feed these guys?
Well, I alternate. I started growing orchids in the eighth grade as a science fair project. So I've been growing orchids a long time. I alternate between has to grow plant and the, Medina liquid fish blend. For a lot of years, I just used the has to grow plant formulation. And then when Medina came out with this new fertilizer, I just alternate those two back and forth, and it works really well. Now, one thing that most people will not tell you is these little ones like you're describing, they're all Phalaenopsis derivatives or moth orchid derivatives. And when they have finished flowering, I'd always let them finish flowering first so you get the full benefit of the flowers, but you need to take them out of the pot that they came in. You need to kind of peel away. They're normally grown in sphagnum moss, and that's a great way to start a little Phalaenopsis, but long term, they will not form healthy roots, and after about 2 years, they normally just start dropping leaves from the bottom and just fold up and die. Get them out of that sphagnum moss and replant them in what's called orchid bark, or any good potting mix that will work for an adult orchid, and you should be able to grow your Phalaenopsis for 20 years or longer. I had an old friend in San Antonio who was also an orchid judge that worked with a lot, and he had a Phalaenopsis in a hanging basket that I think it went for 6 years that it either had buds or blooms on it the whole time. But regular feeding, bright light, but very importantly, after you've had them for a little while, after that first set of blooms has dropped, get them repotted into orchid bark, and your plants will do much, much better. You may have to water them a little more often at first, but you'll have a plant that will last for years and years. As far as the little bloom spikes, As long as they stay green, sometimes they will put on a side branch and have more flowers. But once they turn brown, like you're describing, you might as well clip them off down as close to the leaves as you can.
Okay. It does seem to be putting out a lot of good, healthy leaves. I figured there's some life in there somewhere.
Oh, yeah. But it really needs to put out a bunch of good, healthy roots, so you need to get it some good medium to put those roots out into.
That was my next question. Does it like tight little pots if I repot it with the orchid bark and the substance that they like? Or do they like large pots where they can spread out their roots?
It doesn't make any difference, but it's going to be perfectly normal for it to put roots out over the top of the pot, down the sides of the pot, and that does not mean that it needs to be repotted. In nature, this little plant would be clinging to the side of a tree or maybe the side of a building or something like that. They're what we call epiphytes, and in nature, they don't grow in the ground. They don't grow in soil. They just spread their roots as widely as possible. They grow in areas where either it's a cloud forest where they can absorb moisture, you know, from the fogs moving through, or more often in areas where it rains practically daily. Most of the Phalaenopsis species that the ones like you have were bred from come from Borneo or the Philippines or, you know, true rainforests. So, but, you know, other people, they have to be watered a little, like, daily, but some people will just mount them on a slab, a piece of cork or something like that, with no medium whatsoever, because that's the way they grow in nature. So pot doesn't really make any difference at all. Big pot, small pot, they're going to start putting roots out over the top and going everywhere, and that's just a natural thing for this type of orchid.
Okay, and do you, at the nursery, do you have the substance that I can, I've never heard of orchid bark, don't know where to find it, or the other thing you mentioned?
Yeah, we have an orchid bark mix. The other place, there's a fun place here in San Antonio called E.B. Huntington Orchids out off Wetmore Road, and Liz has lots of good things out there. I think we're probably the only two. Fanix May, I should have asked, I saw Mark and Mike earlier this week. I don't know if they do or not, but I know that Liz will have it. We keep a mix. It's actually a mixture of bark and charcoal and a little bit of core mixed in, but it's excellent for growing Phalaenopsis, and along with some other, once you've convinced yourself you can grow Phalaenopsis, there's some others you're going to have to try that are really special.
Okay, I figured I need to give the orchid world a fighting chance. I have managed to knock them. I just wasn't that familiar with what their needs were, and they keep croaking. So
unfortunately, the grocery store and the places that sell these little things, they're very happy for that to happen. They want them to die, so you'll buy another one. I always figure if they grow and thrive, you'll come get two or three more. So, but that repotting when they finish blooming is very important. Indoors, very bright light. Phalaenopsis are one of the orchids that get by without as much sunlight as many other varieties, so they need a bright window, but they should do well for you. The whole time I was in college, I had an aunt that I had given her one that filled up her kitchen window, and it was just in bloom almost year-round. So that's what I want to hear about your orchids in the future.
Okay. I have discovered that the place I have them on the kitchen table, very large window, afternoon, no sunlight, morning. But does it like direct sunlight or just kind of bright?
Indoors, direct. Don't put it where it touches glass, but indoors, it'd be almost impossible to give them too much sun. If you decide to give them a little outdoor vacation in the warm season, a little morning sun's fine, but no hot afternoon sun. But indoors,
I can do that. Okay.
Yeah, indoors, direct sunlight is fine. They don't like temperatures below about 65 degrees, so don't be in a rush to put them outside.
Got it. I have one other question, if you would, please. I use all of the Has to Grow products. I think I do. And what I put out on the lawn basically is between Grow and Green and Landscape Essential and a whole load of compost. And the yard likes it. My question is, what is Medina Plus for? I have the plant, the lawn. What's the plus?
Medina Plus is a stimulant for the microbes that are in the soil. Medina Plus, you know, is that literally is the best way to describe it, a microbial stimulant. The main benefit, or the place that it's most often used, is to soften soil. The original product was Medina Soil Activator, and they added liquid seaweed and a couple of other things to it and started calling it Medina Plus, and that's what the company built their early days around, was all built on the Medina Soil Activator. And it's so funny, Stuart Frankie, who's a company owner, told me at one point, he said, now don't ever say this on the air, so I talk about it all the time, but he actually has had a lot of his bigger agricultural customers cut back on how much they use, because he said their equipment that used to just be riding along on the rock hard ground sometimes gets bogged down in the soil because it's gotten so soft and open. But that takes for a while. But Medina Plus is used as a microbial stimulant. People put it in their compost piles to help the compost break down faster. Anywhere that you've gotten different things that you would like microbes to help break down, maybe some chemicals got sprayed on there or something like that. But Medina Plus is a microbial stimulant. It's not a fertilizer. It works with the fertilizers, but it has very little, if any, nutrient material in it. So
I have a section of yard that is almost 12 hours heavy sun.
Uh-huh.
And it's connected to a very healthy lawn that doesn't get all that heat. And the lawn is doing fine, but when it gets to this area, it kind of dwindles away and the ground is very hard. I do a bucket of the Medina Plus into this area, would that encourage that dirt?
That will encourage that dirt, but I have to tell you, this might be a better place for Garrett juice, or actually a combination of the two. Garrett juice also works to break down hard soils and stimulate microbial life, but I probably would alternate. And don't do it every week. I mean, do it once a month is enough. But, you know, use the Garrett juice one time, use your Medina Plus the next time, and it will most definitely work to soften that soil and get the microbial population up, which is going to help all your plants grow better. And it will, once the soil is looser and more open, once you build a good soil structure, as long as you're using organic products, that will stay and only get better. The problem is all these people that put out the synthetic nitrogen fertilizers, those fertilizers have no organic material of their own, so the microbes that break them down have to steal organic material from the soil. And every time you use the, well, you know the names, the Scotts and some of the others, Miracle-Gro, you're actually depleting the soil and making it harder. So if you're using products like Garrett Juice and Medina Plus to soften the soil, as long as you continue to use organic fertilizers, the soil will stay soft and loose and open and just get better over the years instead of getting it, quote, have people tell me their soil's worn out. Soil doesn't wear out. It's thousands of years old. But when you lose the organic material, then it starts getting harder and harder.
It's
but
crazy.
You know all about
Dig
that.
Dig up the dirt and then pile on dirt more and then work it out again. No.
There you go.
No, you fix what is there. It's you just feed the dirt. You got happy dirt. You've got perfect plants.
Seems pretty logical to some of us. I don't know why the rest of the world hadn't waked up to it yet.
The last question is pertaining to the Garrett juice, and I work pretty closely with buckets, a 5-gallon bucket.
Mm-hmm.
And I had I don't know how much of the Garrett juice to use in a bucket, 5 gallons of water. Or Medina Plus, if I'd put them together.
Well, figure about an ounce per gallon. So that means if you've got a 5-gallon bucket, use about half a cup.
Okay, 5 ounces, 5 gallons.
There you go.
Okay,
Pretty easy.
Would be both the Garrett juice and the Medina Plus?
That would be my recommendation.
Am I going to overstimulate it? They go in the same bucket at the same time?
if you do them both at the same time, then cut back and use half. Use half an ounce of Medina Plus and half an ounce of Garrett juice if you're going to mix the two of them together.
Will do. I have them both. I have a lot of stuff, and I only use the organic stuff.
You're a good lady.
Believer in it. I'd have a dog, and I don't want her bringing stuff into the house that is not organic.
Well, and you don't want her getting cancer and things that are caused by some of the things that hemangiosarcoma is the worst cancer out there that has been very definitely tied to yard chemicals. So You're probably like me. We like our animals better than we like some people out there.
I've said that in the past, yes.
And getting into political season, it goes double, but we're not going to go down that road. So you get out and have a good day and take good care of your orchids.
Thank you. I'll give it a shot. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy, always.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. All right, Don, let's get those commercials out of the way, and JT and Augie will be up my next two callers.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Going to be JT, Augie, and Lee. JT's first in line. Good morning, JT.
Hey, good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
Hey, I heard the caller a little while ago asking when you're going to get tomatoes. And actually, you have some now, or did a couple days ago.
Okay, well, I haven't walked out back yet this morning, but
I know you're busy all the time.
They're taking 100 cases off a semi right now, 100 cases of more plants to get out and unpacked as soon as we get off the air. But I appreciate you paying more attention than I was able to. I'd take off a little earlier yesterday to fix a well problem, shall we say. But that's a whole other story. What's going on in your world?
I know you stay busy, but I had to stop by there. I had fall planting of onions that has gone mostly well, although I lost a few red ones. So stopped by there, and I knew they'd probably be right there by your checkout. My wife's going to wait in the car. I said, well, I'm just going to real quick grab some onions. Ran in there and grabbed them. Well, while I'm here, I'll take a quick look.
That's a dangerous thing to do.
Yeah, I went in for one thing, walked out with about 10. So anyway, grabbed a bunch of onion plants. And like you said, they'll pot those up and be off to a better start, I hope.
You mean tomato plants, yeah.
There's
no such thing as too many fresh tomatoes.
Well, that's right. If I get a little optimistic and didn't wind up not having enough time to deal with everything. But the other thing is a request for you, or maybe it's a plea, or might even move it on up to I'm going to beg you to do something for us.
Which is?
Limit your use of pronouns. Talking about plants, somebody will call in and say the name of a plant one time, and if you miss that, or walk through and just didn't hear the first part of the conversation. I've heard you talk for 5 minutes of an encyclopedic dissertation about something, authoritative info, and you got no clue what plant you're talking about.
Well,
so
I will.
Repeat the name of the plant every now and then, instead of calling it, that plant. Everything you can imagine except the name of the plant.
I concentrate so hard I do forget to do that, and I appreciate the reminder very much.
I know it's hard. Don't mean to be nitpicking, but it sure would help us if we knew what you were talking about sometimes.
Well, I will definitely try to do that. I will definitely do
that. All right, Bob. Thanks. Have a great day. Talk to you later.
You do the same, JT. Thank you. Goodbye. Okay, next in line is Augie. Good morning, Augie.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
We live right off 281 in the Socalo area.
Uh-huh.
We have almost an acre of backyard.
Okay.
And we're trying to keep some of the sound from 281 from, affecting our home. And we need more privacy and some more soundproofing. So we're trying to find some trees. It won't grow too tall, maybe, 15 to 20 feet tall. That are quick growing.
Okay.
Something that won't break the bank. I'd like to buy it.
Yeah. And what I always tell people about plants is, the price of the plant just is based on how long it took somebody to grow it. And something that's fast growing is always going to be a little less expensive because it spent less time in a growing situation. Out in your area, a lot of folks have very little soil before they hit bedrock. How deep is your soil around this area that you want to plant?
Well, that's very accurate because we hit rock.
Yeah, you may want to
pretty quick.
Yeah, you may want to either create a raised bed or, if nothing else, just berm it up. Just mound it up a little bit, because how quickly the plants grow is going to be determined by how good a root system they have, which is going to be determined by how much soil they have. So you want to choose good varieties of plants, but you also, want to give them the best shot. And if this area you know, is out along a fence line or something like that. There are ways that you could actually create a little raised planter. We used to use railroad ties. I think rock is more attractive and things like that. But if you get a little bit deeper soil, anything that you plant is going to grow better and grow faster. Now, as far as a dense, shrub that's going to help with noise abatement, loquat, so-called Japanese plum, is an evergreen, and you want evergreen because you want to be, limiting the highway noise during the winter months as well as during the summer months. But I would definitely look at loquat. Believe it or not, there are some varieties of bamboo which do not run, which do not spread. They're called clumping bamboos. My favorite of those is called Golden Goddess. Actually had a customer years ago, Golden Goddess bamboo, and it's a clumping bamboo. Had some friends with a similar situation over on 410 in Castle Hills, and they planted a row of that right along the back fence and said their life just changed. And it's going to be evergreen in all but the coldest winter and, pretty fast growing. But it doesn't spread, doesn't run. It's not one of the spreading bamboos. It's a clumping bamboo. The name?
So do you carry that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we do. Most nurseries do. But Golden Goddess.
How tall does it grow?
About 8 feet. Your loquat's going to grow 10 to 15. But, if you get some 8 feet tall, it's going to stop most of the traffic noise and all, because keep in mind that noise is emanating like 2 feet off the ground. So, a low dense shrub like that is going to do the job that you want it to do. Beyond that, there are some of the different hollies. Problem is the hollies are a little bit slow growing, but standard Burford or Foster's, or there's a really good one called Nellie Stevens. These are all ones that'll grow 10 to 12 feet, but they're going to be a little slower growing, but they're dense enough that they, make a real good sound barrier. I hate to even mention it. For years, we used a lot of a plant called Xylosma, spelled X-Y-L-O-S-M-A, but they have suffered in the extreme cold. We went 30 years with no damage, but this is the third year in a row that they have, they have had some damage. But Xylosma is certainly something you could look at. Another option that you might not have thought of is to put some sort of wire. I use the so-called cattle panels, real heavy-duty wire panels. You can do that and then grow a vine up those. And as far as cold hardy, fast growing, dense, there is a plant called Tangerine Beauty Crossvine, C-R-O-S-S, Tangerine Beauty Crossvine. They've used a lot of it down around the Pearl. When you go down there and you see all those kind of tangerine orange flowers in bloom, you're looking at Tangerine Beauty Crossvine. It is evergreen. It is very fast growing. It does have to have some support. If your fence along that area is wooden, then you probably wouldn't have to add anything to help it. It will wind its way around and grow up and over the fence and probably get about 2 feet taller than the fence. But that could be a second layer, or if you don't want to give up the space in your yard to a shrub, just a good planting of Tangerine Beauty Crossvine would do a whole lot to cut down on the noise. And if your fence is 6 foot, the plant's going to grow about 8 feet tall.
Wow. Okay. We'll take a look at that. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure, and always appreciate the call. Anything else I can do for you this morning?
No, sir. You have a great day. Thank you for the information.
It's certainly my pleasure. Don, let's get our last break of the hour out of the way, and we'll be right back with more phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. Don tells me Augie dropped off or his phone quit on him. Call back. We're going to have time for a couple more callers before top of the hour when Mr. Howard Garrett will come in. But next in line is Lee. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning.
Sir.
Yes, I was going to plant a shade tree this year, and I was looking for kind of the perfect one. Was probably looking for the perfect dog breed, but... what I'm looking for is something maybe grow like 20, 25 feet that's not messy, that's maybe 7-8 feet tall where I can bring it home.
Okay.
And I'm 71 years old, so I need something that grow fast.
Grow fast, but stop at 15 feet.
No, about 20, 25 feet.
Or about 20, 25 feet. Probably the best plant for your needs would be what they call a Mexican live oak, also known as a Monterey oak or Quercus polymorphus, its botanical name. But Mexican live oak is in the white oak group, so we don't worry about oak wilt. Of the oak trees, it's probably the fastest growing one. It is evergreen, and typically mature height is around 20 to 25 feet. It's not going to grow as fast as something like Mexican sycamore, but Mexican sycamore is not going to stop till it gets to be 50 feet tall. So if you're looking for that good medium-sized tree, the so-called Mexican live oak or Monterey oak, that would be the top of my list.
Okay, when's a good time to plant that?
About 10 years ago. Second best time to plant it is today, though. From a container, you can plant them 365 days a year. If you ask me what the very best month of the year to plant is, it's probably November, but now is still a good time. Only reason we like fall planting is because it gives the plants a chance to establish a good root system before, you know, the hot and the dry hit. But we're just barely into February, so this is still a very good time to plant. Are you here in San Antonio?
Yes, towards the Converse area.
Okay. Is CPS Energy your energy supplier?
Yes.
If you go to their website and look at what they call their Green Tree Shade Rebate Program, they'll give you $50 credit for planting a Mexican live oak. They want you to plant it, you know, somewhere that it's going to create a little bit of shade. But before you plant it, go and look at that, because for them to give you $50, basically, that's going to make the tree a lot less expensive. And you're sending them all the money as it is, so might as well get. They're not going to send you a check for $50, but they're going to take $50 off your bill if you plant a Mexican live oak and plant it properly.
About how much should that tree cost, like that, or?
If you want an 8-foot tall tree, you're probably going to pay about $150 for it, somewhere between $100 and $150, to get a good container grown tree, which is what you want.
Okay, and how deep a hole I need to dig?
It's going to be about 15 inches, just the same height or a little bit less than the height of the container. What you're describing should be a 15-gallon container, and they're approximately 15 inches deep, so I'd say your hole should be about 14 inches deep. You don't want to dig deeper and then put anything back in the bottom, because over time the tree will sink. So you dig the hole just as deep as the container. Dig an angular hole. I always say a square hole, but my partner always points out, she says, so tell them they can plant a rectangle or something like that. But if you dig a round hole, the roots just want to circle round and round and round and not really take off into the surrounding soil. If you dig an angular hole, then when the root gets to the corner, it takes off into the surrounding soil, and that's what's going to give you the best established tree in the future.
Okay, well, appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. One other tree you can look at, again, it's not going to grow quite as quickly, but the so-called cedar elm is another excellent tree for this area that doesn't get just, you know, oversized. But number one, yeah, I'd look at Mexican live oak or Monterey oak. That's going to be my first choice.
All right. Thank you.
You're sure welcome, Lee. Thank you for the call. Goodbye. Don, do we have anybody else waiting right now? All right, then I'll just talk about a couple of different things, and that is that if you haven't fertilized since last September, October, fertilize. Do it as soon as possible. It would have been great to get it on yesterday, so you got the benefit of that good rain last night. But if you're using quality organic products, they do not have to be watered in. So still a good time to put them out. If you want to minimize weed problems and maximize the growth of your lawn, still just nothing better than putting out a thin layer of compost. 1/4 to 1/2 inch over your lawn is going to do more than anything else you can do to ensure the good growth of the grass and to minimize the weed growth. You need to get the compost on pretty soon, though, because it's the humic acids and fulvic acids and things like that that are in the compost that are going to serve as that natural weed blocker. So don't wait until you've already got a lot of spring weeds coming up and growing. And do not be tempted by these things they sell called weed and feed. That stuff has very toxic chemicals in it, things that are known to cause cancer in dogs, and it's just not something you want to be putting on the yard. But there is a natural product called corn gluten meal. You can get it in what's called the spreadable form with the Nature's Creation label, but it's I wish I could take more time to talk about pre-emergence, but if you're going to put out a pre-emergent herbicide other than compost, corn gluten meal is very definitely the one that you want to put out. Don tells me that Susan has called to talk. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have dwarf abelia.
Uh-huh.
And I was cutting off the top of it where the leaves were very black and crispy. And
okay.
I noticed underneath that it's kind of all dead. Does it grow back? Do I need to be feeding it more? It's like the top is full of the leaves and fluffy,
yeah,
but the very original bottom part is very bare.
Well, and that's because the top, and they're actually compact abelias rather than dwarf, but the top of a compact abelia shades out the light so much that it's normal for them to thin out underneath. Now, abelia is a very hardy plant. It should come back without any problem at all. I have the standard abelias that are probably close to 100 years old around my house because they were there a long time before I was. My house is almost 120 years old. But, that is a normal thing. Since you've cut back the top, they will branch out down lower. But anytime you have a plant that has real thick foliage up on top, the bottom is always going to thin out just because the light doesn't penetrate. That's all you're looking at there. Those limbs should not be dead. They may be leafless, but you've trimmed it back. As soon as we get some warm weather and the soil warms up, your compact abelia, you should come back out just fine.
Should I be feeding it or just let it go? Or
no, absolutely feed it. Same sort of thing you would put on your grass and your other plants. If you want to use a liquid, use something like Has to Grow Plant. If you want to use a dry granular fertilizer, it could be Medina's Growing Green. It could be Maestro Grow's Texas Tea. It could be Nature's Creation, one they call Premium Lawn and Garden Food. Those are all good things. Garret Juice is another good product to use to help something come out. It's a very mild fertilizer. Especially if you're in an area with poor soil, I'd also use one of the good organic fertilizers as well, but Garret Juice will help that abelia come back out quickly.
Okay, and I have one other question about the giant lirio for liriope.
Yes, uh-huh.
The ends of the leaves are turning brown.
And that indicates that, you know, that you've got a little bit of root damage going on. How long have these been planted?
Quite a while, at least 3 years. And they're in pots.
Okay, they got a little dry sometime, probably back during the terrible heat and drought of last summer. The leaves that have the brown tips, those brown tips are always going to be there unless you trim them back. The new growth will be coming out within the next month or so, and it's going to grow up so big and thick you won't see the brown tips. But if you wanted to take, you know, scissors or shears or something like that and go through and just kind of give them a little bit of a haircut, the area you cut, that's going to turn brown too. But what you're seeing is just a little bit of root damage from probably getting too dry. The new growth that comes out this spring should totally hide all those old leaves.
Okay, thank you very much. Have a good day.
You do the same, Susan. Thank you for the call this morning. All right, we're just within a minute or two of news now, and I don't think, it doesn't look like we have anybody else waiting. We will save, we always do our visit with Howard Garrett right after the newscast, and but we will save the last 30 minutes of the show for additional questions, so be prepared to call just before 8:30. I was talking about compost, talking about just so many things to do out there. Your shrubs that are not spring flowering, you should trim back. Things like crepe myrtles, if you're going to trim them, this is the ideal time to do it. The bush roses, not the climbers, but bush roses. We normally say Valentine's Day is about the best time, but that's just, 11 days away. So it's going to be a beautiful day if you want to get out and trim your bush roses back. normally they don't have to be trimmed, but they'll be thicker, probably produce more blooms, and we can prune bush roses back up to two-thirds, whether they're the knockouts or whether they're many of the old-fashioned ones, which is are the ones I really like. But do not prune your climbing roses. Your climbing roses, the blooms they have this spring is going to be on wood that grew last year. So if you trim your climbers, you're throwing away a lot of flowers. But your bush roses, they bloom on new growth. So it would be a good day to go ahead and get that trimming done. Do not prune Indian hawthorn. Do not prune spirea. Do not prune wisteria, mountain laurels, those things that bloom, they bloom on last year's growth. If you prune those, you're going to lose all the flowers. But like I say, the summer flowering things you can definitely prune now, like crepe myrtles. Confederate jasmine probably got a little bit burned from the cold. It's going to produce most of its flowers on, most on new growth, some on old. So trim it lightly if you need to, but no real heavy pruning other than just to take off damaged leaves. We'll be right back after news with our visit with Mr. Howard Garrett here on KTSA Radio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
But as you probably know, don't dial right this minute. The next 30 minutes are very special because we get to visit with the Dirt Doctor. We'll save a little more toward the end of the show for more phone calls. And then, of course, we do this again tomorrow morning from 8 until 11. So if you didn't get your call in early, you'll have a chance a little later. But right now, it's time to say good morning, Howard Garrett.
Good morning, everybody south. What's going on?
We had a good rain last night across most of the area, so this is two good rains in 3 weeks now. I hope that's a trend that's going to continue. How are you guys doing?
Well, apparently we got real nice rain last night that I slept through. one of the things that we've done different in the bedroom, we used to have skylights over the bed, which was about the stupidest design that I ever thought up. And we took them out a few months ago, and almost a year ago, I guess, now. And, man, it makes a difference not getting woke by the rainstorms.
Well, I tell you, and the lightning flashes. Thunder's one thing, but, you know, where my bed is, the lightning is such a bright flash. And last night was one of those nights where it's almost like a light bulb going off. There was so much, and a lot of cloud-to-cloud lightning instead of cloud-to-ground, which means not quite as much thunder. But, oh, man, it's just so good to have the good moisture. And so, you know, both ways. Got a reasonably good night's sleep. Woke up to 68/100 in the rain gauge, and looking forward to an almost spring-like day. This past week for us has been just gorgeous. Temperatures up close to 70, and good sunshine, and lots of moisture in the soil. We're starting to see buds on things.
Well, I hope it's not tricking us. I'm looking out at hellebores in bloom out the window, and a bunch of plants have swollen, quite swollen buds on them, like you say. So a lot of the plants think that we're through with the bad weather. I hope we are.
Well, one of my callers this morning pointed out that when Easter's late, we frequently get some late cold. When Easter's early, spring tends to come a little early, and Easter's early this year, so I'm not putting my tomato graft plants in the ground quite yet, but I'm hopeful that we're beyond the danger of any real killing freezes. I suspect we'll still have, you know, a frost or two, but because this is, what, just the third day of February. But a lot of indications that spring's not very far away.
Well, my helper and I planted onions, a bunch of onions yesterday, and potatoes too. So
good.
We got things cleaned up. We had some freeze damage in the garden where we just used one layer of the frost cloth. It was It was interesting. Turned some of the cauliflower and a few other plants to mush. It even damaged some of the Swiss chard a little bit, but Most of it's coming back, and it's going to rebound pretty well, I think.
You know, it's something, and can't do it as much in the garden because we grow more annuals than we do perennials, but I'm seeing that the plants, especially perennial color, The plants that I mulched and then put the frost cloth over, those seem to come through with much less damage than just using the frost cloth alone.
Yeah, I think
that's something I'm going to, you know, start recommending more highly, because you never know when it's going to get colder than they forecast. And this was one of those times we got down in the real low teens. And it just, things like lantanas and salvias and some of those, it doesn't really hurt them to freeze back. We get more flowers if we can keep the tops from freezing. But as long as they're mulched, you know they're going to come back out in the spring. So I think I'm going to start making more of a point of saying mulch them and then put your frost cloth over the top. And like I say, you can't do that in the vegetable garden nearly as well, but perennial flower beds. And we had an interesting thing. We had a number of the, shall we say, more active kind of people we like in the nursery business had a little get together, and we kind of agreed that we're going to really start promoting more and more perennials and flower gardening, and along with vegetable gardening, just to keep people's interest up. A lot of folks, you know, pretty discouraged over some of the things they've planted and then had freeze back. And we just, I love perennial gardening. I just think perennial beds are minimal maintenance compared to annual beds, minimal expense, and they can be so beautiful. So we're telling everybody to get some of the Dirt Doctor's books that outline a lot of different things and plan on doing more of that this spring.
Well, that's good. That's way to go to stay interested in gardening for a long time. My work in the gardens here, with people coming in that aren't used to it, you always have to be a little bit careful about, yeah, that one's a perennial, cut it down. That one's an annual, it can come out. And, you know, not removing the wrong plants. But other than that, it's fun gardening.
And that can be a problem with volunteers, but we get so many. You know, one of the most encouraging things to me is the number of younger people that we get into the nurseries, young families and, you know, singles. But that's also a big problem with people that their kids have gotten up to that 4 or 5 years of age where they want to help in the garden. But they seem to have sometimes the greatest problem distinguishing between a weed and something that needs to come out. And, you know, and things, something that needs to stay. So it's just one of the many challenges.
Yeah, it's a good learning experience. I'm looking out at some liriope that I had bought. It's the one you and I talked about that's a step up in size, a little bit bigger than Big Blue. Mm-hmm. And some people, in fact, maybe you even commented on the fact that it might be a little more cold sensitive, but ours came through that cold time that we had without any damage at all. In fact, not even any brown tips. So I was glad to see that.
That's I'm glad you brought that up, because one thing that we have found is the one that's been around a long time that they just call giant liriope or giant liriope, depending on who you ask. That one is the one that seems to come through with no problem. Some of the growers are growing some other varieties, and I should have gone out and looked at the name, but things like Emerald Goddess and things like that, some of the ones that have a little wider leaf and also a higher growth habit, and those things don't seem to be nearly as cold hardy. So I don't know that, you know, how much problem there's going to be having them come back from ground level. They probably will, but as far as cosmetic damage, they seem to get hit pretty hard. So anybody that's real concerned about that, tell them just to look for the old-fashioned giant liriope. It doesn't have, it's got a broader leaf than monkey grass, broader leaf than Ophiopogon, but it's not as broad as some of these fancier leaves that are showing up. And, you know, this is just based on two cold snaps of seeing it. But the old-fashioned one sure seems to be more cold hardy.
Well, that's not the name of the one I got. It's a more simple name, and it's between the size of Big Blue and the giant liriope. The one that sold as giant liriope around here gets real tall. It gets 24 inches tall or something. Is that the same thing you're talking about?
Well, yeah, probably 18 to 24 on average. But
it's pretty big.
You know, I'd love to know if you still have a tag. Love to know which one you're getting that's somewhere in between, because, like I said, we have seen a little bit more cosmetic damage on some of the name varieties, but, you know, it's the only way we learn is by growing them and finding out. So if you get a chance, make a note of which one it is.
I think I probably have that in the file. I'll pull it out. It was a pretty simple name. Not thinking of it, but I'll find it and I'll send it to you.
Cause it's, that's good.
It didn't get damaged even cosmetically. It looks really good. I had an interesting reaction from my fern, my holly fern, not damaged at all out in the garden, and the one that's in the pot in the front, by the front door, looks like it did get a little damage. That's on the south side of the house, but doesn't get full sun or anything. It's in the shade all the time. So, yeah, there was a little bit of difference with them. For the most part, though, they look fine, look good. The leopard, I thought the leopard plant was going to be damaged, and it's looking good and starting to flower right now, looking very nice.
Did you cover it, or did you leave it?
No, I did not.
That's good to know.
Covered it all.
Yeah, it got. Go ahead.
My big bay has new growth coming from the stump again, and it got burned bad. I think that the four winters in a row now is going to finally take it completely out. I don't know for sure.
Well, I'm a little bit worried about ours the same way, and.
Something about leopard plant, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, they got a little hurt here in 21, but that has become an extremely popular plant. I don't read a lot of the garden magazines. Just keeping up with what's on dirtdoctor.com is about all I manage to do most of the time, but somebody must be promoting those big time, because we're selling more than we have ever sold. This past year, we probably sold more of them in a week than we would typically sell in a month. So it's a plant, and I like it. I like the solid green form, and everybody says, well, why do they call it leopard plant? Well, they haven't seen the original that has the big yellow spots in the leaves.
Yeah.
But both of them are just, in my opinion, just excellent plants for the shade.
Very dramatic plants. I think that they're a lot of fun to grow. Another dramatic one that I like, too, looks like it has been killed all the way to the ground, at least, and that's the acanthus, the bear's breech.
Yeah.
It was looking good before we ran into that really tough weather, so
yeah.
We'll see if it comes back or not.
I wouldn't be surprised. I think it will almost certainly come back. Our experience has been, of course, you know, you got even probably a little colder than we did, and we were down close to single digits, so it may not, but it usually comes back down here at least, so we'll keep our fingers crossed. I think one thing that that we have seen a good deal of damage to that can be kind of a, you know, eye-catching plant are some of the alocasias, the so-called upright elephant ears. And,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of confusion with people because they said, well, my family grew elephant ears and, you know, they never had any problem. But there really is a big difference between the old-fashioned elephant ears, the colocasias, which are basically, you know, just that big round bulb, kind of up to the size of a softball. And those are the ones that my grandparents grew in Dallas and that we, you know, grew years ago, and they freeze down and they come back very, very dependably. But these new upright alocasias, and there are lots of varieties out there, including some really big ones, they've gotten knocked back, and some of them, you know, actually have not come back out. So I'm trying to be sure and caution people when they come in and say, do you have any elephant ears, that they really understand that there are two distinct plants out there now that are called elephant ears.
Well, there's quite a few. Some of the commercial projects around here are using alocasia that are real decorative, have crinkly edges on them, or mm-hmm. have a purplish tint to the leaves. They're using them like annuals. They're replanting them every year. The colocasia, though, like you said, they're tough as nails. That's the one that's down around Turtle Creek.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in some real big plantings down there, and it's been coming back for decades.
Yeah, Yeah. And as long as people understand that they're annuals, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. There's some of them that are beautiful, even in pots, and some of them very, very distinctively marked. There's one out there called African Mask that is just a gorgeous thing, but it definitely is not as cold hardy. And I was reminded when we were over at the gift market a couple of weeks ago in Atlanta, and of course everything is frozen back, but something that they've done in one of the kind of routes we drive between where we stay and the marketplace is they've used the big perennial hibiscus in mass plantings in the boulevard in the median of some of these things. And talk about something that just is just so just maintenance free almost. Their only problem is trying to keep the weeds out of it. But that's a plant, and I remember the first year we were in business over 40 years ago, we got a really cold winter, and back then we just called them mallow hibiscus. There are so many new and different ones out there now. But these things froze down, and even in containers they came back the next year. But if people are looking for something that's spectacular but low maintenance and lots of color in midsummer, they're sure to be recommended. There's some beautiful new varieties of those out there these days.
Yeah, I like all the hibiscus, and those are especially fun because you think they're gone, and here they come right back.
And, yeah, there are a couple of things that I wanted to ask you about. We're getting down here, we can still find good bagged compost, but it's getting darn hard to find bulk compost that's not full of biosolids. And our, you know, water people, our sewer treatment people, they're actually paying these people to take the biosolids because so much of it's generated and they don't really know what to do with it. But very discouraging. I encourage people, you know, to top dress their lawns with compost, but being able to buy it by the truckload instead of by the bag, it's getting pretty hard. Are you seeing any of that in the Dallas area?
Yeah, there's a couple of new companies that are coming in, and I've been trying to get a hold of them and talk to them. One's called Champions of Nursery was telling me about them yesterday, and they've got mulches and compost, and then there's one that we've got in this area. I don't know if y'all have down that way or not, called Organic Recycler, and they're bunch of grinding up trees and making compost, you know, with a base of shredded tree trimmings, which I really, really like. I'm continuing to be concerned about people putting manure in compost, and I hate it because manure is such an important thing to use. But that residue of picloram and clopyrrolid both is a real issue. I mean, it's a real worry, you know.
Yeah. Oh, it most definitely is. And we tell people if you want to test it, you know, take some of it and soak it in water and then go look for a dandelion or some henbit or something like that and pour the water over it. But and that'll do
grow
it
some
for the
peanuts.
Yeah. Which is a fun plant to grow, by the way. But we don't have either of the ones you just mentioned. We have one that's up in the hill country, actually pretty close to Roberta, called GeoSource that it bases their compost and mulches there. It's a little bit higher priced, but they sure seem to have good quality, and I think we're going to start recommending them more. But some of the big ones that used to be good suppliers of quality material, vegetable-based material as opposed to manure-based, they're just including some things that I would rather not see in compost. But I guess that's going to be a problem pretty much everywhere, because we've got people used to using more compost, and we just haven't gotten the supply is not keeping up with the demand, you know, as well as it should. The other thing,
ones that make it from the shredded tree trimmings, I think the ones to concentrate on. Plus, the fact when people with ranches and larger properties call me about what to use first, what I tell them is the first product to put out on the land is shredded tree trimmings and just let it turn into compost. You know, that's a very, very cost-effective way to get started.
And it's always been, I've always thought it was kind of crazy, but the compost makers actually charge the tree trimmers, I guess I think they call it a tipping fee, and they charge them to be able to come and dump the chips that they've made there. And so I tell people, hey, if you know a tree trimmer, just tell them, you know, they don't have to pay to get rid of those trimmings. You can come dump them on my driveway or whatever else. But I don't know. It's a strange world out there. But there's still a few of them doing it right. The other thing that I had never heard of, and I really don't think it exists, but I had somebody call me yesterday and said that a friend of theirs said that there was some place that you could register big trees, heritage trees, that they had some sort of place that they keep a record of this, and somehow they are more protected from, you know, encroachment by development or things like that. I can see a local entity doing that, and it would be a very good thing to do, but they said they thought there was some state program. I've never heard of that. Have you?
Yeah, A&M's got one. We actually started it, and they ended up taking it over and ignoring what we had done. We actually had a contest on my radio show of people turning in. It's where I discovered the national champion pecan tree. It was one that was entered into that contest, and we had advertisers put up a bunch of products, and we had awards for champion trees that were turned in and all that kind of thing. And then later on, A&M started a champion tree contest, and they have some of the trees that we had come up with on the list, and some are not. So it's not a very well-organized deal.
Yeah, this would be a good registry, but other than just, you know, public pressure from the public, is there anything that does help protect those trees from development or eminent domain or anything like that?
Well, the tree, what do you call them, the tree plans in the various cities.
A landscape, I know what you're talking about.
They deal with quantity, not quality.
Right.
And, you know, caliper inches and that sort of thing. So the really special trees, I had the A&M people, for example, come out here and look at my ginkgo and also at the Parodia. Mm-hmm. And my Parodia, my Chinese, Persian ironwood is by far the biggest one in North Texas.
Uh-huh.
Maybe all of Texas, and they had no interest in it at all. They were like, "Oh, we don't do ornamental trees." And my ironwood is as big as the champion Lacy oak almost. It's huge now. And they weren't interested in my ginkgo at all. They said that, you know, but that's where I found out about the true Texas champion over in
Weatherford.
Over in East Texas, it's champion ginkgo. It's about 250 years old.
Okay.
It's got trunk diameter of about 3.5 feet, something like that, and it's a beauty.
Wow.
But mine is competing with the ones in North Texas that are over 100 years old. Mine's as big or a little bit bigger than all those now. I may have, at this point, the second biggest ginkgo in Texas.
Wow.
And it's only about 40-something years old, 40, maybe 45 years old at the most.
Well, it shows what a good organic program will do for you. Well, the big pecan tree over by Weatherford is still the biggest of the pecans that you know of, isn't it?
Well, unless they've gone in and changed it again. You know, we had a problem early on. The Texas Forest Service came out for some reason and decided to remeasure the tree, and they actually took away the designation of it being the national champion. And we, you know, spent some time working on getting them to do it another time, and they brought it back to the tree. So currently, unless they've changed it again, that is the national champion tree. I need to talk to that owner over there, because the last time I saw it, it had gotten a little storm damage, and we need to figure out how to get some lightning protection in it and get the poison ivy that's growing around the base of it taken care of without using a bunch of chemicals and stuff. But, yeah, it's still there.
I'm glad to hear that. One other thing that just occurs to me, and I don't know if we've talked about this or not, but Dr. Kirby was telling us with some recent research that has come out. We've always, you know, known that dogs really shouldn't eat too many acorns, but we're more concerned about especially smaller dogs having a problem with them creating a blockage in the intestinal tract. But apparently their acorns are so full of tannins that they can be highly toxic to dogs if they eat too many of them. So Dr. Kirby's recommending that people, if you see your dogs going out wanting to eat acorns, try to discourage it because their dog's actually being poisoned and sometimes, you know, not surviving eating too many acorns. So it might be something good to pass along to people.
I appreciate you bringing that up because Tater and Nellie definitely are eating some. They have been. They kind of alternate back and forth between bark, sticks and acorns, so
and ginkgo fruit.
Well, no, they don't. These two don't. We've had that problem with one dog, and we've never had it happen again. So
that's good. That's good. Well, we want those guys around for a long time. So do where you can. Do discourage them from it because it's apparently making it into the veterinary journals now as well.
Appreciate you bringing it up because our dogs definitely do it. I've been surprised that they haven't, you know, gotten clogged up from it, but they seem to be just as healthy as they can be.
Well, you've got them on an organic program of their own, which is always a good thing. But anything else going on up in your part of the world? It's starting to feel like spring, even if it doesn't look a whole lot like it yet. But like you said, with something's starting to bloom and buds starting to swell. I hope it's not too far away.
Well, I hope we keep talking about what we're talking about here. Everything starting to bud out and leaf out. Don't have some really, really rough, crazy weather again. But just like I've told my guy here, keep that floating row cover handy because it sure can come up on us again.
Yeah, that light-colored floating row cover, because I've heard from three or four people this week that got that one that's a darker color or green and said things absolutely froze underneath it, said it's like they hadn't put anything at all down. So,
interesting how it works.
Yeah. Well, many, many interesting things going on, and as always, I don't know where our 30 minutes goes so quickly, but I love telling everybody that DirtDoctor.com is by far the best source on the internet for information. So you guys keep up your good work, and I think we ought to do this again next week.
Sounds like a plan. Tater says goodbye, and he'll see you next week. Nellie's in some other part of the house, don't know where, but we'll see everybody next week. Enjoy those healthy gardens in the meantime.
And you guys as well, Howard. Thank you so much. We'll talk next Saturday. All right. Well, Don, let's get a break out of the way and see if anybody wants to do another phone call or two.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. Back to gardening. Apparently lots of interest in talking about things. Jimmy, Carolyn, and Sheila are my next three callers. Jimmy's first in line. Good morning, Jimmy.
Hey, good morning, Bob, and thank you for everything you do, brother. I appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for calling. How can I help?
I'm going on year three with some St. Augustine I bought two seasons ago and spent a lot of money on. And my backyard, it's so thick and flush, it's like walking in sand.
Love to hear that.
But my front yard, I don't even know if it's going to come. I don't even know if I'm going to have a front yard this year. And so here's what I want to ask you and maybe make you mad. I don't want to make you mad. We're all organic. I mean, everything, right? But
great. Fantastic.
But when I was a kid, I lived on the southeast side of San Antonio, and my dad would have a dump truck full of black dirt dropped on our driveway the week before we got out of school. Mm-hmm. And so our first 2 weeks of summer was spreading this heavy black dirt.
Yep.
And And our yard was, I mean, really nice.
Mm-hmm.
All I can find is this real light, they call it top dressing, and yeah. I've done that the last yeah. 2 years, and it's doing nothing, and it's aggravating me, the sticks and so I'm going to stop right there, and you're going to tell me whether I'm being crazy. I want black dirt.
Okay. Well, good luck in finding it. I really don't know where to tell you. You might, it's just going to be a matter of calling around and telling people what you're looking for. You know, I grew up in that area, in that era, too. And the biggest problem from that is, two things. People's yards got built up so high that the grass was 4 inches above the level of the sidewalk, which made for a muddy yep. sidewalk and harder to mow. And plus, when people got away from using the blacker soils and went to the sandier ones, people started getting a lot of nut sedge brought in with what they were spreading on their yard. And there's nothing wrong with the practice if you can find it. It's just, but, you know, be aware that you're still going to have to fortify it, so to speak, because a lot of that old, topsoil is just, it's very low in organic material and very low in nutrient. If I were looking for it in this area, I'd try to talk to somebody, northeast of town or, just due east of town where we still have some good dark soils. You go very far south, you're getting into sandy country. When you're out around Universal City and Randolph and that area, you've got some good, deep, dark soils. And if you want to put that on your yard, in some areas I can see where it would really help. In other areas, it just, like I say, it has the problems of building it up. But if you're in a spot where you have really thin soils, whether it's thin soil on top of caliche or thin soil on top of rock, then you very definitely, your grass is going to do better if you build it up a bit. But
the builder, who I won't mention, told us when we were having a house built, oh yeah, we're going to put 6 inches of topsoil on after we clean your yard up, stuff like that. Well, we were one of the first houses built in the neighborhood. Yep. And I watch what they do, and I bet there wasn't an inch and a half, and that's on top of all the break-off slab and rock.
Oh, yeah.
And boards.
Sheetrock, sheetrock crap and things like that. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So I feel like the problem with that front yard is there is just no soil for the roots of that grass.
Yeah. And, again, you either go to some different ground cover that doesn't need as much grass, or you build the soil up, or you fertilize and water much more frequently. And that's a very common problem. And I know Howard Garrett uses a golf club, a discarded golf club that he's cut off at an angle, and he uses that as a probe when he goes around on building projects and things like that, and just sticks it down in the ground to see how much soil you actually have. But I would certainly, agree that that could easily be the problem. If your backyard's that beautiful and your front yard's not, it's probably just the amount of soil you have there. And again, you will gradually build it up with the so-called top dressings are just compost and sand, and the compost breaks down over time, and so you're just not going to see the same results. But short of actually building it up, the other thing you can do, it'll very definitely change the look of your landscape. But if you were to berm up some areas, actually create little kind of raised mounds out there and then landscape those appropriately, you get something of a different look, but you would certainly have something more attractive than dead grass.
Yes, sir. Well, I appreciate your...
I wish the problem had an easy solution, but... I was hoping
you were going to say, look, I'll be out there this afternoon with a dump truck of dirt just for you, Jimmy.
No, I shouldn't mention builders like Poolty and some of the others by names that just scrape away what little bit of dirt they have. And we've got one going just up the street from the nursery that I just, they took one of the big, beautiful large lots, and now they're building like six houses on it or something like that. And those poor people aren't going to have, they're going to have zero soil. And it's just going to be real interesting to see what the builders do. But, and I know we're going to have people coming down the street looking for plants, and we're going to tell them, you know, if you're up there, you better plan on raised beds. You better plan on all sorts of things to do, because, you just simply aren't going to grow good grass without a minimum of 4 to 6 inches of soil. And that doesn't even get into talking about problems with trees and shrubs and things like that. But I think you've identified the problem very succinctly, but exactly what to do about it is going to be a little more challenging.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And I'm amazed that out of all the builders in town, that whole box, we put all the names in the box, you reached in there blindfolded and grabbed the right one.
Well, I watched them bulldoze hillsides north of town on some routes I used to drive a little differently, and just, you know, almost made you cry watching them bulldoze these majestic oaks and elms and things like that, and just, you know, and sell a subdivision of 100 houses with not a tree in sight. And that just, I don't know, I just think it's wrong. The cities have their so-called tree ordinances and do virtually nothing to enforce them, or else you get idiots like we've got up in Bernie that went in and said, oh, we're going to knock those trees down. We'll just pay the fine. We just want to be rid of the trees. We don't care if we have to pay a fine. So I think it should be a capital offense myself. But anyway, well, listen, you get out and have a good weekend, and I do appreciate the call.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you, Jimmy. Appreciate it. Don, let's get our last break of the show done, and we'll come back and talk to Carolyn and Sheila.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Looks like it's going to be a pretty day out there. Maybe not quite as warm as yesterday, but just looking out my window here, it looks very inviting out there in the garden. We're going to talk to Carolyn and Sheila, and then we'll see what kind of time we have. Carolyn's first. Good morning, Carolyn.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
We have a Schefflera, or I think it's a Schefflera. Suddenly decided to wilt terribly. It's about 20, 22 feet tall.
Okay.
And I just don't know what to do with it. So I'm wondering if possibly, I don't know, it's overwatered or... needs a bigger pot.
Okay, so it's in a container, and you must have a high ceiling if you have one that big.
I'm probably overestimating, but it's tall. It's been growing healthy for 15 years.
Well, if it's droopy, then it probably is a water issue. And what kind of pot is it in? Does it have a drain hole in the bottom?
It does.
Okay. I would turn that and, you know, do this carefully, get somebody to help you with it, but I would turn that tree over on its side, and I would take a screwdriver or something like that, and I would just kind of jam it up and root around a little bit, because many times when you have a pot that only has one or two holes in the bottom, it can actually get plugged up with roots, and the pot will stop draining. It may have drained well for 10 years, and all of a sudden it gets plugged up. So first thing to do is to be sure that, you know, that the pot can drain. Now, if it's still in a nursery container that has like 6 or 8 holes around the edges, that's probably not an issue. But if it's a more decorative pot and there's just a single hole in the bottom, that is the first place I would start, because it could indeed be not necessarily that you're watering it too much or too often, but it's that the soil, that the water's not able to drain out. You could get some of the same thing from getting too dry, but if it were getting too dry, you'd have some yellow leaves forming, especially the older leaves on the plant. It wouldn't just droop. If it's just drooping, then it's either early stage of not enough water, or it's a later stage of having stood in water. It's not the water that hurts. It's the fact that the water drives all the oxygen out of the soil. Without oxygen, the roots suffer, and that's when things start drooping and, you know, eventually worse if it's not corrected. So first thing I would do is, it's like check to be sure that it has perfect drainage. While you have it down on its side where you can look at the upper leaves, check very carefully. Scheffleras are very susceptible to two insect, or well, not really an insect, but two pests. One of them is a mite that they call a spider mite, and it's very common on the top part of the plants because when you get way up high like that, you tend to be in an area where the plant's getting hit more by your air-conditioned vent and especially your heating vent, and that hot, dry air is really conducive to spider mites, and Scheffleras can certainly have a problem with those. The other is the hard brown scale that they can get. You'll normally notice this because the leaves are getting, you know, a little bit sticky, and that's just an excrement from the scale. So while you have it turned over, check for those two problems. Let me ask you one other thing. You know, the way the Scheffleras grows, it puts out a stem. It's called a petiole. It's actually the stem of the leaf, and then it has the big leaves in a cluster out on the end of that. As the plant has grown, is the number of leaflets, which is what we call the smaller individual leaves, has the number of leaflets decreased on each one of those stems, or do you still have six or eight good strong leaflets on each stem?
It's about eight good leaves on each stem.
And that goes all the way to the top? Oh,
yes.
Gosh, you're taking excellent care of the plant, that sounds like. And that's, Scheffleras will, in nature, it'll grow 30 feet tall, and believe it or not, it'll have red flowers on it eventually. But I would check the drainage before I did anything else. While you have it tipped over, I would look for any sign of spider mites or scale. Next couple of times you water it, I'd probably add a little bit of Super Thrive and or a little bit of Garrett juice to it. I think this is very recoverable. But you do need to check it carefully.
Okay, excellent, great advice. Thank you.
Well, you are certainly welcome. You probably have one of the biggest ones in San Antonio, so take good care of it.
We certainly will. Thank you so much.
And if you ever want something smaller, that so-called Hawaiian Scheffleras, which is a compact Scheffleras that only grows to about 6 feet. It's also an excellent house plant, but I'm happy to know that you've grown one that big and obviously so healthy. So you're a good gardener. My hat's off to you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Carolyn. Thank you. Goodbye. All right. Sheila's next. Good morning, Sheila.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I live in Kerrville. Sure.
Uh-huh.
I live in Kerrville. And I'd like to plant, well, on a very rocky 10 acres, and I'd like to plant some maple trees. Is that doable, or what kind of maple should I get?
Okay.
What's your advice?
And you have rocky soils around Kerrville, there's no doubt. Do you have just...
I'd say rocks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have just like a shelf of rock if you dig down, or do you just have lots of big rocks mixed with some decent looking soil around the rocks?
Big rocks, and if you try to dig down, there's rocks underneath.
Well,
there are probably some areas that have soil. Like if I could find them, there are a lot of trees, a lot of cedars and oaks.
Okay, tell me about the oaks. Do you have any oaks that have really nice big diameter trunks, or do all the oaks seem to stop at about 5 or 6 or 7 inches diameter?
There are some down in our pasture that have nice diameters. The ones up around the house stop at about 5 or 6 inches.
Okay, and which is the area that you want to plant some maples?
Probably up around the house, like to be able to see them.
Yeah, you're going to have to do something to get more soil for them, and real shallow soils like that. And when you see, you know, lots of oaks, but all stopping at about 5 or 6 inches, that tells me there's just a shelf of rock if you went down a few inches. It's not just individual rocks, but it's just, it's just a shelf of rock that the roots can't get through, which is why the trees are basically stunted is what they are. If you were going to plant maples, you need to create either some big berms, some berms that are 2 feet tall or more, or else you would need to create some raised beds, which you could do very attractively with good old hill country stone. But you need to get where you've got a couple of feet of soil in a, you know, fair-sized area to be successful you know, with the maples. Now, the only maple to plant is, you know, in an area where you're wanting a bigger tree is going to be the big tooth maple like they have over in the Lost Maple State Park. And they are available. You can find them, especially around some of the hill country nurseries up that way. And you can grow those successfully if you will indeed give them more soil to grow in. Now, the other option are some of the so-called Japanese maples, which there are many dwarf forms that never get over, you know, 4 to 6 feet tall. Howard Garrett has actually had the same tree growing in a pot in his front yard for like 25 years or something like that. So if you're looking for that type of maple, they grow as an understory tree. You would need a shady area to plant them. They do need good soil. You're going to have to either build up an area where you've got, you know, more soil, but not going to have to be as big as you would for the big tooth maples. Or you could grow them, you know, in a molasses tub sized container, and you could do well with that type of maple. But stay away from, the shantungs and the so-called hybrid maples. Either go with the true dwarf Japanese maples or with the big tooth maple. Those are the only ones that are going to consistently take our, you know, cold winters and hot summers.
Okay, will I have to order those, or can I find those at nurseries too?
You can find them at nurseries. In fact, the next month or so is probably when you're going to find the greatest selection. Most of them are grown in either Northern California or Oregon, and most nurseries get a pretty good, there's some of them come out of Oklahoma now, but this is the time of year that most nurseries are starting to get them in. Make some calls before you make a long drive, but you will definitely find them. I know we carry them here at Shades of Green. I'm pretty sure they carry them over at Fanix. They probably carry them at Rainbow here in San Antonio. I don't know Kerrville, but if you go up as far as Fredericksburg, the nursery up there called the Friendly Natives, they're probably going to have your big tooth maples up there.
Okay, and how big do I want to buy them? How tall should I look for?
I tell people buy the biggest tree you can afford. You know, all you're doing is buying time. The longer, I tell people, think of a plant as, you know, a guest in a fancy hotel. The longer you check in for, the bigger the bill you run up. And it's the same way with trees. The longer that tree stood there on somebody's property being grown, the bigger the bill it ran up. So you're just buying time is all you're buying. That a little tree is just as good as a big tree. It's just going to take a while to grow that big. And maples are slower growing, so do buy as much as the budget allows, as large as the budget allows.
And the Japanese maples, I want to have shade for them. Is that what you said?
Yes. They'll take morning sun, but they have to have afternoon shade. I know folks down at San Antonio Botanical Garden, they have a little area that is a Japanese garden, and they have struggled because they don't have enough shade for them. So morning sun's okay, but hot afternoon sun will very definitely fry the foliage on them.
Okay, the big tooth maple, though, will take whatever.
You give it good soil, and it will do just fine.
Okay, thank you so much.
Good question. I appreciate the call. Thank you, Sheila.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Well, we've got less than 60 seconds here. Do get out and enjoy today in the garden. Be planting some more of those winter vegetables. Be planting some snow peas. Be planting your onions. If you're South San Antonio or south beyond that, you can probably plant potatoes. If you're north San Antonio, I would wait a couple of weeks. Most nurseries have pretty good asparagus roots in right now. If you would love a fresh asparagus garden, be a great time to plant them. Just plant plenty, because asparagus, individual plants don't produce a lot. But if you've got the room to do it, it's an attractive plant. And boy, there's nothing much better than good fresh asparagus just picked out of your own garden. Good time to fertilize, good time to put some compost on the yard, good time to trim back the summer flowering plants and the ones that are just evergreen. Those plants, we're getting into a good season to do your pruning there. Above all, remember to join us again tomorrow morning when we do this right here from 8 till 11 here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.